Tonight on The Download, from the Smashing Pumpkins, Jimmy Chamberlain, gardening tips from the Chicago Botanic Garden, and another installment of The Download on Chicago business. Now, here's your host, a man who delays votes on health care all the time, Justin Kaufman.
It's more like delaying going to the doctor. My delay is, something's wrong, but I'm just going to see if it's wrong in a week, right? Or maybe a month. Let's just see what happens. Good evening, everybody. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here. Beautiful night in Chicago. We broadcast on Michigan Avenue from our Allstate Showcase studio. Very excited to be here. As always, a great show lined up tonight. But it is. I'm very grateful to be on the air in WGN and to be able to broadcast from this great institution, especially in this wonderful, great city that is known as Chicago. So let's get to it. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You're always welcome to call or text. Like I said, we got a great show lined up tonight. Coming up at the big table, Jimmy Chamberlain, the famed drummer for the Smashing Pumpkins. We're going to talk about music, talk about his career in the band, the ups and downs, and we'll talk about life. I think he's got a lot to say about what's happened in music, but also, you know, living a life as a rock star. Jimmy Chamberlain's seen a lot. Think about those days of the Smashing Pumpkins starting off and being the music darlings. Not just here in Chicago, but around the country, around the world. And then for the next decade, being on stage in front of hundreds of thousands of people, constantly going from big city, big European city to another big European city to another festival. I mean, really has a lot to say about rock and roll and the rock and roll lifestyle. We'll talk with Jimmy Chamberlain coming up in the 8 o'clock hour tonight at the big table. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, something more important, near and dear to my heart, hydrangeas. We're going to talk. I'm very happy to say that the Chicago Botanic Gardens is back. Jacob's here. We'll be talking about hydrangeas, rabbits, all sorts. This is our annual sort of summer check-in when it comes to gardening. If you're a longtime listener to The Download, you know I've had my share of ups and downs with my own garden. I have a little area in the front. It's not much, not garden, not necessarily growing anything. Just mostly flowers, flower beds, hydrangeas. For whatever reason, I've been complaining about this on the show, but whatever reason, last year I bought a couple hydrangea plants. You know, dropped some coin. I'm not going to lie to you. Went to the high-end places. I can't remember specifically, but $40-$50 maybe. You know what I'm talking about? It adds up. They were beautiful last year until the rabbits came around and kind of bit around them, and I talked about my rabbit problems. This year, all the greenery springs up, no hydrangeas. Yeah, it's just like a green plant. So I start asking around, you have to ask here, there, and people are like, well, some hydrangeas, they bloom every other year. And I'm like, what? Who didn't tell me that at the high-end store? I didn't put that kind of coin down for every other year. And then I'm like, well, maybe did I prune too much? Did I actually prune the bulbs off of these plants? So we're going to talk to Chicago Botanic Gardens about what to do with my hydrangeas. And also open up the lines, 312-981-7200. What do you want to know about your garden as we get into the hot, hot time here in Chicago, in the Chicago area? What do you want to know? Botanist in studio tonight, we'll talk about that. Also coming up tonight, 10 o'clock, the worst. Of course, we're complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. So we got a lot of opportunities tonight to talk hydrangeas, to talk about, you know, it's the worst when your hydrangea is every other year. What's the point of having a flower that's every other year? It's an annual. I think I have that wrong, too. An annual would just be one time, right? Perennial? Whatever it is, it should be bloom every year. You don't wait all winter long, and right? In Chicago, you don't wait. You don't go through all of it. Protect the area so it just pops up the green leaves. You want the flowery bulbs. That's coming up tonight. We'll talk about that. I feel bad for the Chicago Botanic Garden because they're going to feel my wrath. They don't have the answer for me. I'm going to lose it. Also coming up tonight, Download on Chicago Business, coming up right after Rob's News at 7:30. Tonight, we turn the tables on Signature Bank. They will be in studio tonight. We'll talk with the co-founders about small banking, small business. I mean, really, the interesting, I had a fascinating conversation about how do you compete in the banking world if you're not one of the giants today? Because you remember Chicago. I was just thinking about this today, about all the small banks and different banks that were local. Think about banks like LaSalle Bank or First Chicago. We go way back into the 80s, 90s. And over time, those have been gobbled up. Conglomerates, commercial banking has become something in the United States that's akin to Walmart or Amazon. And so we'll talk about how does a small bank, how do middle-of-the-road banks, local banks, compete against the Bank of America's and the Chase's and the others that are dominating the field across the country. We'll talk about that coming up on the Download on Chicago Business. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martyr, Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Coffin. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin with you till 11 o'clock. Let's start with the carryout. Here are today's top stories. The Senate health care bill will not be voted on before the 4th of July recess. I think the most patriotic thing to do would be to take the recess away. And if they complain about it, make them do a report on the Declaration of Independence, single-spaced, both sides. That'll teach them. Senate Republicans didn't have the votes for the bill, so they will delay. They don't shelve, they delay. For Democrats and cynics alike who believe this signifies some sort of victory, you know they are delaying because most of the senators who are questioning don't think the bill goes far enough to defederalize health care, right? So a delay may be for negotiations to make this a more conservative bill. So be careful. Stop. I wouldn't trip over your gloating. I'm going to skin your knee. Also, this is a purely Republican fight. Listen, any health care bill that served up that would repeal or replace Obamacare is not going to be supported by Democrats. So it's somewhat disingenuous for the president or others to pin any of this discord on the left. So the trouble here is that the bill is causing friction within one political party. So the negotiations aren't going to be they're not going to be compromising towards the middle. This is a race to the fringes. I think the Republicans win regardless. Also, the GOP senators who were called to the White House today to talk to the president, I wonder what that was like. Why am I thinking about the scene from The Untouchables? You know what I love? Baseball. Team game. I wonder if Trump showed the senators his fake Time magazine cover that was hanging in his office at the golf course. Yeah, the Washington Post reported on this. I guess it's from his old apprentice days, but there's a Time magazine cover that hangs on his wall, even though it's not real. Huh. Fake news. On purpose. Hanging on a wall. I mean, the layers. And for the Washington Democrats, sad you weren't invited to that meeting. You should just go home right now. Take the recess now. No one wants you there. Take a couple extra days after, too. Tell Al Franken to stand down. Stop making Rick Perry look like a fool. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. Instead, regroup and get Rahm Emanuel to draw up some blueprints on how to win in 2018. Because right now, you are as obsolete as companies that make fake Time magazine covers for you to hang on the wall. Locally, Speaker Madigan presented a budget proposal today. Actually, Democrats, Representative Greg Harrison. What's in it? Please tell me they tax tap water. How about steps? Are we taxing steps yet? No, but income tax and corporate taxes will increase, but there's a compromise that Dems would accept a four-year property tax freeze. But then they compromised on that compromise and exempted 18 school districts, including Chicago. Oh, alrighty then. The Democrats say that the budget is a combination that includes a lot of the issues from the Republican proposal, including 5% cuts across most state agencies. So is this it? Or will I have to change my scratch-off lotto games for next week? Something tells me this isn't it, is it? In weather, what can you say? I mean, come on, this is beautiful, right? Let's all remember this weather when it's 20 degrees and sideways raining in October, right? You know that's going to happen. In sports, who says the Cubs have leadoff issues? Yesterday, Wilson Contreras became the last guinea pig for manager Joe Maddon. And boom, he led off with a home run. I mean, it was a solo shot, but still, it seems like the Cubs lineup loves the leadoff spot. They got the win last night, and Rizzo ends up back in the leadoff spot tonight, and he gets on base. Also, Max Scherzer and Jake Arrieta. See how that goes. Cubs enter tonight one game down to the Brewers in the Central. The Brewers are on the road in Cincinnati. Ryan Braun activated from the DL today. On the South side, oh gosh, is it over yet? Season's over. The Sox lost again last night to run their losing streak to 4-7 of their last 8. Reinforcements are on the way in the form of Carlos Rodon, who will start tomorrow for the White Sox, his first start of the year. Quintana goes tonight. Let's hope that he continues his upward trend so we can get some trade offers. Also, he's on my fantasy team, and I really need a quality start. Come on, Jose, for me. Once, for me. What else? Oh, it's All-Star voting time. It's the last week, and the Cubs are getting quite the World Series bump. Pretty much every Cub is second in the voting category, although Chris Bryant is leading over Nolan Arenado in Colorado. To give you an idea on why the system is so flawed, Jason Hayward is fourth in outfield voting in the NL, and probably because of his speech in the locker room after Game 7. Also, Ben Zobrist has 1.2 million votes, and Kyle Schwarber just under a million. Man, if All-Star votes counted for runs, huh? They don't. Oh, and the White Sox have nobody. Actually, Avi Garcia is fifth in the voting with less votes than Ben Zobrist. Oh, that's awesome. All right. Bulls newcomers were introduced at a press conference today at the United Center, but all questions seem to be about Dwayne Wade and a buyout. Hilarious. This time last week, it was all about a buy-in. How quickly we change course. Pack said that a buyout wouldn't happen unless the Bulls got something in return, and I'm guessing it wouldn't be skybox tickets to Cavalier games. Nope, they'd want some of that money back, and that's probably not happening. Also, Michael Carter-Williams let go. He's now a free agent, so now the Bulls are down to 27 point guards on the roster. Also, no guarantee from Pax that Rondo will return. Also, lots of media speculation about a super team coming together in Cleveland. Carmelo Anthony's name has been mentioned as an addition to the Cavs this offseason. I don't understand the fascination with this dude. I really don't. He hasn't done anything. Seems to be a locker room distraction. Never really does well on a team where he's not the alpha. So, I don't know. Maybe he should come to Chicago and replace Jimmy Butler. Da-doom-sh. My prediction, he goes to Cleveland and they get worse. And finally tonight, Jewel Osco unveiled their new mascot. The furry, red, round, one-eyed monster named JoJo now becomes the face/spokesperson for the grocery store chain. Okay, weird. Who does he replace? The old lady in deli? Patricia Heaton? Wasn't she once a Jewel spokesperson? Or the old man who does voiceovers? This week at Jewel, grapes. This week at Jewel, flank steak. This week at Jewel, deodorant. Please tell me that's how JoJo talks. That's the carryout for June 27, 2017. The carryout doesn't have a mascot, but we do have a lot of styrofoam. Don't worry, though. I'm sure it's biodegradable, right? Do we know yet? No? All right, coming up on the download on Chicago Business, we talk local banks. The guys from Signature Bank are here. One of my guests tonight. And coming up at 8 o'clock, Smashing Pumpkins drummer Jimmy Chamberlain. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Marks here. How are you, my man?
Hey, buddy. You know, I heard you mention Carmelo Anthony's name, right, you know, off the top there. And any time that I hear his name, I feel the need, Justin, to channel ESPN NBA analyst Stephen A. Smith.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Because Carmelo Anthony annoys me so much.
He's got an annoying sort of look when
Justin,
he plays basketball.
I've got to tell you that the only things that Carmelo Anthony has added in his 83 years in the NBA are more sweatbands, elbow pads, and knee pads. He is persona non grata in most NBA locker rooms, and going to Cleveland would be a phenomenal mistake.
It's perfect, man.
Had to get it off my chest.
And you got the, and you're right, more knee pads and shoulder pads than necessary.
Awful. It's awful.
I'm with you, man. Every time I hear his name,
awful.
I'm like, nah, that's not going to work. So,
ugh.
But hey,
just
good for
York.
The Cavaliers.
Just
I
stay
hope
in
he,
New York
I hope
Phil
he goes
Jackson
there.
And his bad back and his special chairs and just stay there. Okay.
All right, here's the news.
I'm calm now.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Do
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for a new segment here on the show called A Download on Chicago Business. It's a weekly segment where we talk shop with Chicago area business owners because Chicago has a long history with being an economic engine, not just for the Midwest, but for the whole country. And that has not changed as Chicago entrepreneurs continue to grow their businesses. And we want to make them share their stories to help us better understand ours. And as you're aware, the segment's brought to us by Signature Bank. Tonight, we turn the microphones around. Signature Bank is a Chicago bank that specializes in small businesses. And it's kind of in the news right now. The U.S. House passed a bill to roll back some financial regulation, parts of Dodd-Frank. This move is one that's met with positivity from both sides of the aisle because one of the unintended consequences from regulating the industry after the recession was its effect on small businesses and banking. We'll talk about that, but we'll also talk about the financial industry here in Chicago. How do locals thrive in a market that continues to be dominated by giant banks? We'll talk technology, security, and of course, business. In studio tonight, the co-founders at Signature Bank, Mick O'Rourke, Kevin Bastuga, and Brian Duncan. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for
having us. All right, so, I mean, did I get that right in the sense that, I mean, really, let's start with the story. I mean, you guys, as a local bank, your big competition, of course, are the big giants. I kind of made a joke at the top. It's like the Amazon and Walmart of banks, you know, as they sort of compete against each other. But as a small business, bank and a local bank, how do you compete with giants in the financial industry?
Well, it really comes down to personal service. We made a decision when we started the bank 10 years ago to focus on small to medium-sized businesses here in Chicago because we felt that was a neglected industry segment from the bigger banks. And we felt that those middle market customers, the family owned businesses, that they wanted to have a relationship with their banker. They wanted to be able to talk to their banker about what their financing needs were. They didn't want to be credit scored and deal with credit processing, whether a computer tells you to make a loan or not. So we actually go out, we visit with every customer, we get to know the business, get to know the business owner, and it really is relationship based banking.
I mean, at one point, if you ask my dad, and he'll tell you this, that, you know, relationship-based banking is the only kind of banking. You know, he's not a big fan of the idea of like you just mentioned, the idea of sort of printouts and automated loans and not really knowing who's behind. I mean, when you talk about the idea of relationship-based banking, is that something that is just gone by the wayside? Is that that's still around?
Yeah. No, I mean, especially, I mean, we're all Chicago people. As we were walking over here, I was thinking about this, that, you know, we were walking to the Tribune Tower and somebody said, do you know where it's at? I'm like, yeah, we all know where the tower is. And Chicago is a very parochial town where everybody knows somebody that knows somebody. And that really is another form of relationship. So when you talk about you walked in the bank, you feel welcome. There's somebody from the neighborhood you might know. And when you go out and you visit your clients, we know intimately what they're about and what makes their business tick and who their suppliers are and who their customers are. Because, again, I go back to my initial statement, Chicago is a very parochial town. Mm-hmm. And we travel and we have customers in other states, and it's not that way outside of the Midwest. So we take great pride in it, and I think that's one of the reasons we started the bank in Chicago, because of that.
You know, as you talk about Chicago, as we talk about banks in Chicago, I was talking earlier about the 80s and 90s, and there seemed to be so many more local banks, even banks that weren't necessarily local had Chicago in their name. That was a good first Chicago or other places where you felt like, oh, that's a Chicago bank, even though maybe they weren't from here. Talk about that. Talk about, you know, you guys come from the banking industry. You all sort of got out of one bank and came to start Signature. Let's talk about why you did that and what the banking sort of landscape was like when you guys left.
Sure. You know, we had worked at a couple of regional banks in the Chicago area. That's where we were all trained and kind of sort of grew up in our careers. And throughout our careers, as we progressed on in those banks and started handling commercial loan portfolios, the common theme at a few of these institutions was, you know, one of growth, which every company wants. But that growth really focused on moving up market with the transactions that they wanted to do. So in the early 2000s, we kind of watched this happening is that banks were wanting bigger and bigger transactions where, right, you know, it used to be a $2 million loan. Now they wanted a $5 million relationship and then a $10 million relationship. And being a Chicagoan, you know that there's a massive family-owned, closely held industrial base here. And that's what we had done our entire career. So we felt there was this vacuum that had developed where you know, the third generation metal bending company or plastic injection molder in Elk Grove Village or Arlington Heights or on the South Side, who, you know, the grandfather had a relationship with his banker for 30 years. The third generation owners were now finding themselves dealing with lower level people that didn't have decision-making power. And, you know, inherently owners want to deal with owners. So that was a big part of the premise of why we saw this sort mm-hmm. of vacuum developing and decided to go off on our own and try and fill that.
Mick, is Chicago still a financial town? I mean, I think of LaSalle Street and I think of, you know, being a kid who was wowed by coming downtown and seeing all the banks and other places. But as we get to 2017, has Chicago changed its identity when it comes to the financial industry?
No, I wouldn't think so. I mean, Illinois still holds the record for the most number of charters in the United States. So there's 500 charters left, but I'll go back to when we started the bank in 2006, there were 700 charters. So as consolidation happens, we feel that the stronger are going to get stronger. The smaller players will still be on the outset, but where we're seeing our success and where we're getting our new clients from a business standpoint is the larger regional banks that can't provide that personal service that our customers crave. You know, Kevin, myself, and Brian, we have relationships that we've handled for 30 years that are banking with us now, and we take great pride in that. I mean, there's very few banks, I think, in Chicago where the senior management team has relationships that they've handled for that long of a time period.
Have the people that you work with, the relationships, 30 years, are their needs change? I mean, when you talk about 30 years of banking, small business loans, trying to continue to grow their small business, a lot has changed. Like 30 years ago is the 90s. I mean, at this point, I guess it's the 80s, right? I mean, but the concept being that, I mean, Chicago has seen, not just Chicago, but the country, the world has seen financial changes. And how do you keep up with the needs of a customer that you've served for that many years?
Right. Well, no doubt. The biggest change in banking has been the technology side, the treasury management needs of our customers. When we started the bank 10 years ago, our original business model had us opening 10 branches around the Chicago area over 10 years. Today, we've got two. And the reason for that is electronic banking, online banking, deposit scanning from your iPhone or iDevice. All of that's changed the need for brick and mortar. And we were ahead of that curve because when we started the bank 10 years ago, we invested very heavily in our technology, knowing we were going to have to compete with the bigger banks. So we were one of the first banks in the city to offer the deposit scanning from your iDevice. We offer all the bells and whistles from a treasury management service perspective that the big banks do, and yeah, we can compete day in, day out.
Do you guys have to think about what's coming up in 10, 15 years? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were thinking about investing in technology, you know, 10 years ago, what do you have to think about now?
So the perfect example is when we started the bank, a number of banks had started, for lack of a better term, messenger services, where they would drive. And this is only 10 years ago. It's amazing how technology just leapfrogs us. They would drive and pick up your deposit. If you said that now, I think people would look at you like you were crazy. But we constantly have to think about what's out there. And what we do is, it's funny when you talk about how has our customer base changed. I'll look back and I'll say that 20 years ago, 100% of our customers, 80% were manufacturers, 20% were service or other. It's 50-50 now.
Right.
So you talk about how do we have to change? We had to learn those businesses and how to bank them and how to serve them. And we've done that. And that's what we have to look at, is the technology is going to continue to improve. And how can we embrace that technology to serve our customers?
All right, let's talk about regulation. And let's do that after the break. Co-founders of Signature Bank in studio tonight, Mick O'Rourke, Kevin Bestuga, and Brian Duncan. We're talking about small banks, small businesses. On the download on Chicago Business. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. And the guys from Signature Bank are in studio tonight. Co-founders Mick O'Rourke, Kevin Bestuga, and Brian Duncan, talking about small business banking. I mean, this is an area, and we were just kind of chatting in the break about a place where a lot of people take it for granted, especially when it comes to personal banking. I know you guys do much more with businesses, but is it the same at that level? I mean, as businesses, do they take for granted the same kind of the things that personal bankers do?
You know, fortunately, no, we haven't seen that.
They take it seriously.
Just the opposite. They take it seriously. Right. This is their livelihood, and this is generational, and they want to have something to leave for their children, their grandchildren. So That's the whole reason why we started the bank. It's to serve the needs of these family-owned businesses. And fortunately, they still value the banking relationship.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about relationships and this idea of thinking about what's next, and we kind of were talking about, you know, you got to think about 10, 15 years down the line. I mean, as much as you serve entrepreneurs, you are entrepreneurs. This is a banking, this is a popular industry, and it's an industry that continues to thrive, not just here in Chicago, but around the world. I mean, how do you look at the business of banking?
So, as we project out 10 or 15 years from now and beyond that, because we plan to be around for that long, first of all. But, you know, we talked about banking these companies for generations. When we bring on a customer, we want to be their bank for the next 20, 25 years or as long as they're in existence. So when you think about those life cycles, you see a lot. You see generational changes. You see how a company deals with business cycles, especially this last 10 years. For some of the younger folks at our bank who had never lived through an economic downturn, this has been a sort of a fantastic learning experience,
right?
for the whole industry. But one of the things that we think about, because a lot of these businesses deal with these generational issues, and one thing that all banks are going to have to deal with is sort of how do millennials value, if they value, their banking relationship at all. And from the business standpoint, you know, the next generation of owners are coming out of the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm.
Their frame of reference and experience with banking is completely different.
And I guess that's what I was getting at with the first question. Do you see similarities in the way that the generations view banking? I mean, it's changing. I mean, I think of the way that I view banking much differently than my father's generation or my grandfather's generation. I mean, it's much to their chagrin when they think about me, but I only think that my son is going to be different. I mean, do you have to, as bankers in this business, adjust to the way that the population sort of views the banking industry?
I think so. You know, as Brian was mentioning in the break, that personal banking for a lot of people has just become commoditized. It's so technology reliant. You really don't know that you need a banking relationship until you really need a banking relationship. And that's really true on the business side. As Mick was mentioning, we get a lot of new clients from larger regional banks that, they had their personal account there, so they opened a business account there when they started their company. And then as they mature and they grow, they realize they have different needs in terms of technology and the accounts they need and credit. You know, mm-hmm. they need business credit. And that's where that lack of relationship sort of plays right into our model.
Right.
Like, I go out and I help out at 1871 every other Tuesday, and we have office hours. And we sit there and they'll come in with their pitches, and they're phenomenal. I love hearing it. They're truly entrepreneurs. They're doing great things at 1871. They're all to be commended. And I'll say to them, we're right across the street. Bank with us. Start a relationship. And it's almost like pulling teeth. But we have to be there, and we have to ask for the business, because those companies are going to be successful. But it really, it's just...
Do they not think that they need that relationship? Or why is it pulling teeth?
And we were there when we were starting our business. You don't think about the little things at that point. They don't see the banking as a major part, but we're there telling them, we're just here to help you. We're here to assist you. If we can give you guidance, that's great. But here's one little aspect of the business that if you start this now, it's going to help you in the future. And when, you know, people get blinders on when they're trying to start their business, and we've seen it.
Well, I mean, we've had a lot of conversations on the show, even the Download Chicago Business, about entrepreneurs and starting businesses and small businesses. Small businesses in the news. We just saw, as I mentioned in the lead, some partial rollback of Dodd-Frank and financial regulation. I don't want to get into the political side of it, but how often, as you guys have really dedicated your lives to the banking industry, how often do you see it where something will look good on paper at the government level in D.C. or even in the state of Illinois, where they say this is good for small business, this is good for banking, this is good for loans, what have you, or protections against another recession, what have you, that it has unintended consequences. We've heard this over and over, that the small business landscape, and it really played a big part in the 2016 election, sort of handcuffed by some of the things that were really meant for larger banks and regulation for Wall Street that really came down on the backs of small businesses and small business banks.
Right. So, you know, Dodd-Frank in particular, when it was written and the law says that it's only applicable to banks over $10 billion in assets. So by regulatory standards, a community bank is less than $10 billion. So it wasn't intended to affect banks our size. However, going through the crisis that we went through, it's human nature for the regulatory agencies to sort of push the best practices downhill. And that's certainly what has happened. A lot of regulation that comes out of Washington is intended to enhance the safety of the banking system, enhance credit standards, and a lot of the times what it does is it restricts the credit that it was meant to safeguard. So the folks that they're trying to help often get hurt because it makes it too
hard. How do you guys work around that? How can you not only thrive as your own business, but how can you help small businesses when there seems to be handcuffs on, you know, from regulations that were passed down from governments?
We try to, again, we take this approach where, again, we live in a regulated world. We started a bank. We understood it was going to be regulated. And we have open dialogue with the regulators. And I think from day one, we've always been proactive with them saying, you know, you can't paint with the broad brush. What we're doing is not comparable to what the larger banks are doing. And we've had actually great success that way. And they like our customer base. They like the fact that we're serving our community. I mean, that's really the major test for the banks. Are you really serving your communities? And I think 7 days a week and twice on Sunday, we do that. We serve the local businesses. We serve the local customers. And I think that's probably one of the first litmus tests for the regulators. We're not looking at huge opportunities in Puerto Rico. We're looking at the six county area.
Well, that's a great place to sort of wrap up where we started, the idea of you guys being a local bank and what you guys can offer where giant banks may not be able to. Being a Chicago bank, what's that mean to you guys? What's it mean to not only be a bank that serves local communities, but this community? You guys came up through the regional banks here in the area. I mean, talk about what it means to be known as a Chicago area bank.
Right. We're all very proud Chicagoans. Chicago is a very diverse economy. We know the difference between Northsiders and Southsiders and Sox fans and Cubs fans. It's a very diverse industry, lots of different businesses. We deal everything from service companies to manufacturers. We enjoy what we do. We enjoy helping small businesses. We enjoy growing and helping see them hire people and develop new products. It's Chicago is a great place to do that. At the end of the day, the state's got its challenges. The city has its challenges. But this is a good place to do business.
Guys?
As we try and bring in additional clients, we have an incredible leg up. If it's a Chicago-based business, we'll have an immediate connection with them because we're a Chicago-based business. In fact, I talked to somebody 3 years ago who was thinking about joining the bank, and he was from out of town. He said, I don't know what it's like to go on a call and make an immediate connection, as Brian said, a Northsider, a Southsider. We can do that because we know this market. We study it, and we study it by actually wearing out shoe leather, by going to visit clients, and it gives us an incredible advantage, and we're proud of that.
All right. Kevin, anything?
No, that's pretty much it. We're happy to be here. Thanks for having us on.
Co-founders of Signature Bank, Mick O'Rourke, Kevin Bastuga, and Brian Duncan in studio for the Download of Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thank you, and thank you for being a customer.
Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is a CEO, a tech visionary, an entrepreneur, and a jazz musician.
Oh, most importantly.
Did I mention he's also one of the biggest musicians in Chicago history? I'm talking about one of the best drummers Chicago's ever seen, Smashing Pumpkins drummer Jimmy Chamberlain. The Joliet native was the original drummer with the Pumpkins. Jimmy teamed up with Billy Corgan, albums like Gish and Siamese Dream. He's credited with bringing the Pumpkins alive. Before he joined, they were using a drum machine. And after he came aboard, well, the rest is history. The long, sordid history that saw the band catapult themselves to worldwide stardom and all that goes with it, including drug addiction and subsequently getting kicked out of the band, only to return. Chamberlain is a jazz drummer at heart, playing alongside saxophonist Frank Catalano, and he's also a tech visionary and entrepreneur who has helped musicians and other entertainers navigate the new, scary digital world. Jimmy Chamberlain is my guest tonight at the big table. Jimmy, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Justin. Thanks for having
me. Jazz is a big part of your life. You grew up with jazz.
I did. You know, my dad played clarinet, so, you know, whether you liked it or not, that's what was playing in the house. So a lot of Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Artie Shaw. You know, and the stuff that used to drive me nuts about, you know, what my dad would put on, because obviously once he knew I was going to be a drummer, then it was all about, you know, Gene Krupa, you got to listen to this again, or
right.
Did you really hear it, or Dave Tough, or any of those, you know, Buddy Rich, and, you know, you, as your kid, you're going, man, this stuff is so corny, and this is really, you know, my brother, I was the youngest of six kids, so my brothers were, you know, my brother's a drummer, so he was listening to a lot of progressive music, and I was thinking, man, you know, Tony Williams, have you ever heard that, Dad? Or Elvin Jones? Or have you ever heard of Coltrane, you know? And now, I mean, I'm such a huge, you know, big band nerd, almost kind of embarrassingly listening to Johnny Hodges.
What did the jazz, listen to the drummers and your dad forcing you, what did it teach you about the music or that you keep with you today?
The role of the swing drummer was really to be a part of the narrative, right? And that's, I think, something that I keep with me at all times. And that, you know, a lot of drummers are really consumed with kind of keeping the beat or, you know, writing things that are, you know, representative of maybe the most difficult things they can play. And for me, you know, I've always thought, and this goes back to, you know, Corgan and I's early conversations about the role of each, the accountability of each musical instrument in a particular song. You know, everything should be a part of that narrative, right? And we used to say, you know, when you listen to a Pumpkins drum part, you should be able to identify that song, right? It should be as identifiable as the verse or the chorus. So, and those guys, you know, Krupa and those guys really just knew what the emotional context of what they were doing was at all times. And they were always ready to kind of support that in the best way.
I've read some stuff about you and the emotional part of drumming. That's important to you. I mean, you're documented as one of the most powerful rock drummers of all time. But in your eyes, I mean, the most important part of the instrument is the emotion that comes with it.
Well, I think, you know, you have to realize that, you know, technique obviously is an important part of playing, well, anything, being a writer or being an artist or being a you know, musician and drummer, but really the role of technique or the job of technique is to allow you to get what's in your heart out into the canvas of your instrument, right? And some people can do it with very few brush strokes, right? Like, you know, some artists like a Mondrian, right, will be a very kind of basic painting, right? But still have the same emotive, you'll still have the same emotive reaction as something very complex, right? Just like Charlie Watts, you know, plays very simply, you know, I tend to play a little bit more complex than that. And other guys like Vinnie Colaiuta, you know, go on and take it, you know, to the uber complex. But really the idea is just to get the emotions out onto the canvas of the instrument and then, you know, use that as kind of, you know, furthering the destination or getting to the destination.
Well,
of the song.
I mean, I think of the music that you're well known for with the Smashing Pumpkins and even your jazz work as well. But there is an emotion to it. I mean, there is a pounding, there is a heartbeat, if you will. When you listen to some of those tracks, I was listening to it all day today, from Gish and Siamese Dream, the drum is there and it pierces you. I mean, is that by design when you guys are putting that together, the idea that the drum is going to be such a heartbeat for the music?
Well, I think, you know, to your point about them playing with the drum machine, I think, you know, Billy is such a great songwriter and such a great utilizer of what's around. You know, I think when him and I first got together and realized that, you know, I was a fusion devotee and he was a closet Mahavishnu fan, you know,
That's what you guys realized.
I mean, he started writing to the strengths of my ability to play. And really, you know, that was a great environment for me. I mean, it allowed me to play to my ability. Because, you know, the early Pumpkins music was not something that I was really that interested in. I wasn't really interested in coming in and replicating a drum machine.
Right.
I was interested in going to play at the Metro, which is why I went to the audition and I got the gig. But, you know, where the music went from there was really born of our own interest in progressive music, you know, metal, but also progressive jazz.
At the time, I mean, you were coming into it. You weren't necessarily an alt rocker. You weren't
To his point, you know, I had stonewashed jeans and a pink T-shirt on. And I think the second practice I came to, I had a baseball uniform on because I was playing on a softball team, right? So, I mean, you know, these guys were going, I remember James and Darcy going, I don't care how good this guy is. There's no way he can be in the band. And Billy just going, hey, come on, you know, the hair can change. And, you know, because I had a mullet.
Well, that's a big part of the style at the time. Yeah.
I mean, you know, from Joliet, that was considered cool, right? But when it came up here, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, these guys have turtlenecks and medallions and their hair's purple. I'm thinking, like, did I miss Halloween or, you know, what's going on here? But, you know, when we got together and started playing, it was, you know, all that stuff just went away. And it became something that was, you knew was going to be, you know, a great, crazy, you know, dangerous ride. It's like when the gate, when the chair harness comes down on the roller coaster and you try that one last time to see if you could get out.
Oh, man.
And you know
there's
you can't.
So much there. I mean, you know, the music, we'll get to the Pumpkins in a second, but talking about the drums and what you do for Smashing Pumpkins throughout your career, and now you go back to jazz. I mean, you find yourself with Frank, and you're doing all sorts of stuff now. Talk about the idea of making a transition and going back to playing a different type of music.
Well, that was really, you know, probably one of the most difficult things that I've done as a drummer, just because, you know, jazz to me is a very sacred space. And having not played it for so long, you know, it really demands a lot of dedication. You just don't go and play the Green Mill. You know, you don't come off the Pumpkin tour and then go play the Green Mill. I mean, you're walking into a church of jazz music, right? So for me, when Frank called me up and said, hey, you know, I know you're not working with the Pumpkins anymore, and him and I were friends. We had a lot of, mutual attraction to the same kind of music. Do you want to come and play? I said, you know, you've got to give me some time. And I took about a year and a half, and really just worked up to the point where I felt like I could at least come in and hold my own.
That's hard to believe. I mean, like you said, I mean, you're coming off of amphitheaters and worldwide festivals to have to retrain yourself.
But it's, you know, drumming is a long, slow arc, right? And even my brother, who's a drummer, when he finally came to see me play at Andy's, and we were playing, you know, Impressions by John Coltrane, you know, with the super fast right hand stuff, and my brother Paul said, man, you know, how long did it take you to get your right hand? And I said, about a year and a half. I mean, because that's how long it takes, right? And I'm still working on it. And that's the great thing about the drums, right? It's just never over. The great thing about the Pumpkin success is that I've got access, right?
Right.
So I got access to Peter Erskine. I got access to Steve Smith. I've done clinic tours with Terry Bozzio, Greg Bissonette, Kenny Aronoff. I mean, guys that have been, as a young kid, I only wanted to be on Modern Drummer. I didn't want to be in a rock band. It was like, I wanted to be on the cover of Modern Drummer. That was my thing, right? And it's like, if the band was going to be a vehicle for that, so be it. But let's be clear about what the destination was going to be here, right?
Right.
So to be able to tap into that and continue my own education, right? Steve just wrote a great book that I'm going through right now. There's some great materials online right now that weren't available to me as a young drummer. I mean, if I wanted to learn something, I had to put my thumb on the record and slow it down, right? I mean, now you got YouTube is incredible, right? I mean, I'm not cheap, but the other day, like, my wife's car needed a new alternator. I went out and watched it on YouTube, and I got my brother up there, and we put it on ourselves. I'm thinking, I'm not going to pay $1,000 for this, right?
I got
wrenches.
Right.
This looks easy, right?
There you go. That's what makes you a tech visionary.
Right. I mean,
and you can do an alternator off of YouTube.
I mean, you know, I just think that there's a lot of stuff out there. And for me, you know, I grew up, you know, went to Catholic school and had some great teachers, and really, you know, reading was a big part of my life. So, you know, my journey through the music business, my journey into tech, it had everything to do with my ability just to read.
Well, let's talk. We'll talk about the tech world. We'll also talk more about Smashing Pumpkins. Jimmy Chamberlain, the drummer, in studio tonight at the big table. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, my guest at the big table tonight. Jimmy Chamberlain, arguably one of the best, if not the best, Chicago drummer of all time, the drummer for the Smashing Pumpkins, in studio tonight. You know, I was thinking about this as we were putting this together. It's 25 years. I mean, you just had the 25-year anniversary of Gish. And now you're coming up on the summer preceding the which would be 25 years of Siamese Dream. So
yeah,
this time
30 years in 2018 October from the time I joined the band.
I mean, thinking back 25 years, I mean, let's talk about this summer, 25 years ago. I mean, coming off of Gish, and Gish, of course, a huge success, an independent record at the time, Caroline Records. And now you're making that transition. Here comes, everyone's waiting to see what the Smashing Pumpkins are going to do. Take us to the summer of what that would be, 1992, and talk about it.
So that album, you know, Gish was a big success for us. And the great thing about Gish was it was an early exercise in bootstrapping, right? So the Pumpkins started playing live in October of 1988. And what we made a deal with everybody that we would, in order to get away from any record company, if we potentially were to sign a deal, in order to get away from any type of record company involvement, that we would save up our own money and then we would bankroll our first record, right? So we saved up $30,000 from playing around Chicago. We went to Smart Studios and recorded that album, and I don't know how many days, but the drums were done in a couple days. I mean, a lot of that stuff was just one or two takes and then just move on, right? So the album went on to, you know, be CMJ Album of the Year, Debut Album of the Year, and it had, you know, it did everything that you could dream about.
I mean, it was a perfectly timed record with Nirvana and everything coming out and the music business and what the tides of pop culture changing. People were looking at the Smashing Pumpkins as, oh, this is a band that belongs in right in the zeitgeist of where this country was.
Exactly. And what was great about it from a drummer standpoint is that we really were catching a wave. Me, Steve Perkins from Janes, Grohl, Matt Cameron, Joey Warnaker from Walt and Mink. I mean, there's a lot of us drummers who were talking about, like, we're going to be the guys to, like, eliminate hair metal, right? Because, I mean, because we're going to play this kind of polyrhythmic, syncopated, cool stuff with lead guitar solos and all this stuff that we like, but it's going to be kind of the cool version of that. You know, coming off the success of that record, Virgin kind of got blindsided by it, right? And we released it on Caroline, even though we had signed the deal to Virgin, because it wasn't cool to be a major label band back then. Pumpkins, however, Corgan and I, we always wanted to be as big as we could possibly be. We always wanted to have big hit songs. We didn't want to be, you know, Pavement. We wanted to be Cheap Trick. I mean, they were, right?
Yeah,
we
wanted
to have big songs AM radio.
That's
right?
Good to hear. I mean, it's interesting to hear because, I mean, I think at the time, and you look back, it becomes revisionist history and this idea of, like, what's an independent band or want to sign with a major label.
It was all optics, right? I mean, it was really just a bunch of BS. I mean, from my standpoint, because we lived in Chicago, right? We were like, hey, why wouldn't you want to achieve the maximum? Right? Why wouldn't you want to work as hard as you could and achieve the maximum? Why pretend, right? So Virgin came back and said, look, we kind of got blindsided by the success of Gish. We'd like to repackage it and re-put it out on Virgin. And, you know, Billy had already started working on Today and Disarm and Cherub Rock. And, you know, we had this whole, you know, clip of songs,
we were already convinced
these were number one singles, right? and Virgin was basically saying, "There's no way you guys got lucky. There's no way that you know you're going to beat this."
Yeah,
right?
let's just repackage and do what you did before and like, make some money off it. Right?
Like looking at us four, just, if they didn't know anything else but just looking at us four, they were probably right. Just looking at us standing there with our thrift store clothes on.
So what did you guys do?
I mean, it was really, I mean, I got to hand it to Billy, right? Billy was the one who said, look, we'll just walk. If you don't want to sign, if you don't want a follow-up record, then we're not going to let you re-release the old record. And it was really, you know, his conviction in the band's ability to do something like Siamese Dream. I mean, we were, you know, me in particular, I mean, I was kind of, you know, waffling between, hey, what if they're right and what if he's right, you know, and him being the songwriter, we put our chips in his basket and the rest is kind of history. But I got to hand it to him for having, you know, the integrity to go and stand up to those guys because, I mean, here, you know, him and I were sharing cans of beefaroni. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's easy to have integrity when you live in a mansion, right? But I mean, I lived in like underneath a girlfriend's table.
At this time, Gish is out. I mean, it's a critical success. I'm assuming not a ton of money that's coming your way nothing, right?
Awful.
But you're right on the precipice of recording what will become one of the most successful alt-rock albums of all time. Did you know? I mean, you said we feel like we have a couple number one hits here. I mean, could you feel the excitement and anticipation around the idea of possibly having something worthwhile in Siamese Dream?
You know, it's really not that palpable, right? It's not that palpable in the moment. I mean, we knew that we were good. We knew that we were dangerous. We knew that I knew that I could play. I knew that, like, Geek USA was going to be a roller coaster ride that most people hadn't been exposed to. I knew that songs like Soma were going to catch people off guard. Songs like Disarm. You know, we had a deep bench, right? I mean, because of Billy's ability to write both things that were symphonic and things that were very rooted in kind of Judas Priest. I mean, the parameters in which we could operate were so wide.
Right.
Because I could go from brushes, you know, to two Bs in a heartbeat, and we could roll songs like Soma out or Mayonnaise and then go to a Geek USA, which a lot of bands really
did. The sky's the limit.
We had a lot of gears, right? And most bands had maybe one, if two gears if they were lucky. But we really liked the song. When people ask me, what were your favorite, the most challenging parts, or what you enjoy the most? It was really, you know, songs that were more symphonic, like Tonight Tonight or Porcelina or those types of songs that were more, they really required you to come up with things that were compelling.
Right.
It wasn't just like, oh, this is a great rock song. I'm just going to lay down a foundation and we're going to be, you know, off to the roller skating rink. I mean, the songs like that really, because we used to sit around and talk about Cole Porter or Thelonious Monk and really look at those songs and try to examine what it was about, like Thelonious Monk, where on top it sounds like a nursery rhyme, but underneath it's this kind of multi-tangential reharmonization of chord changes. That
you guys are talking
as a
rock band, you're talking about that stuff.
Well, it's stuff we listen to, right? So it was really kind of worth kicking around. You know, what was compelling about Fela? What was compelling about even Depeche Mode? And as I got more into the band, I started to look at bands like Love and Rockets and Joy Division, bands that I never would have listened to in a million years, right? And now Peter Hook and I are friends, right?
Yeah.
And Robert Smith and I are friends. But back then, I was like, man, I was listening to Return to Forever, right? Or like Tony Williams' Lifetime. I mean, I was like, there's no drums in this. And what's a bass doing? It's so weird, right? But, you know, posthumously going back and looking at that stuff, you see. And as a musician, you go, okay, I can go and mine this stuff, and it'll make me a better player.
Jimmy Chamberlain is my guest tonight, the longtime drummer for the Smashing Pumpkins. We're talking about his career, the Pumpkins' career. We'll also talk about his career after the music. Let's take a break for the news. We'll come back. More with Jimmy Chamberlain here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Jimmy Chamberlain, one of Chicago's historically one of the best drummers to have ever played here in Chicago, the drummer for the Smashing Pumpkins, of course, as we're talking about tonight. Also a CEO, a tech visionary. We'll get to his world as an entrepreneur.
Love that word, visionary.
Visionary.
Right?
One of the things about Smashing Pumpkins, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of, I mean, the success that you guys had after Siamese Dream comes out and even the subsequent records. I mean, you went from local darling and 120 minutes kind of band that might get on the MTV once in a while to heavy rotation.
Oh yeah,
all the music, amphitheaters, festivals, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of
people.
We
were on a cow on Michigan Avenue.
You were on a cow on Michigan Avenue. Take us there.
That's when you know it's really gone off the rails.
I mean, did you at the time? I mean, you had a group, and it's very well documented that there was dysfunction. Was it easy for you guys to handle that fame, or was it a death knell?
Well, you know, the thing they don't prepare you for in rock and roll school when you sign up as a teenager is just, you know, the other 22 hours of the day, right? And that's really where the schooling needs to happen, right? You know, what do you do with yourself? You know, you're in a very high-octane emotional state because of your job. That's your job, is to be in that state and create in that state. You know, so you have a lot of that stuff on tap, which doesn't necessarily prepare you for the kind of a world that everybody else kind of lives in, right? And for me particularly, you know, I always had issues with drinking. I grew up in a Catholic family. It was, you know, work all week and then fish fry on Friday and then drink over the weekend. And, you know, birth control was just stay pregnant. You know, everybody just had lots of kids and, you know, it got crazy. I mean, and, you know, not knowing any better or not having those types of tools, it just kind of snowballs. And then when you add fame and fortune and more money, you know, the accountability starts to go south. You know, for me, having kind of run that gauntlet and, you know, now looking back at the other side. So I don't drink or smoke or anything for 15 plus years now. When my first daughter, when my oldest was born, my wife and I decided, you know, we would just raise our kids without escapism, right? So right. I managed to kind of leave that all behind me. But nevertheless, you can see examples of people in that business or even radio or any other business that are unprepared. You know, I mean, it's a push to the summit, right?
Right.
And when you get to the summit, nobody tells you what they did after they got to the top of Everest,
I mean,
right?
There's so
what
much,
do they do
I
when
mean,
they're rolling
right.
down the other side yeah. of the mountain?
There's so much excess. And in your case, I mean, like I said, it's well documented about your drug addiction and heroin. But, I mean, when you think back to that time, and a time that just an awesome time. And I don't mean awesome in the word that like, oh, that's so awesome. I
yeah,
mean
yeah.
like just the overwhelmingness of playing in front of hundreds of thousands of people. Is that a good time in your brain? When you go back in your memories and reflect on it, was it a great time? Was it a bad time? Where were you?
It's a transformative time. When I look at it, you know, it's one of those things when you look at things in the aggregate and you look at your life holistically, you know, all of those components have value. The person that I am now, I mean, I have two beautiful kids. I have a responsible relationship with my wife. I have a responsible relationship with my instrument. I'm very, very involved in education. I sit on the board of Columbia College here. You know, I was a vice president of my kids' Montessori school. I mean, I'm really, really believe in literacy. You know, all of those things. You know, when you go back to was it good or bad? You know, you get into this kind of mortgage business of your own life,
yeah,
right? And
right.
what would you potentially mortgage out of your past to potentially not have the present
right.
time that you have right.
right
now, right? So when I look at that stuff, I say, yeah, it was awful, right? My father died. I went into a tailspin. I didn't know any other way to deal with it. There was no one to talk to. My bandmates and I didn't have that type of relationship. Management was not interested in anything that didn't make money. And you add to that, the more excess you create, the more records you sell and the more magazine covers you get on, right? You become more of a celebrity by being more of a jackass. And all of that stuff adds up to just this cauldron of your responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, again, though, you know, looking back at that stuff, you can't posthumously engineer your life,
yeah.
right? My kids know about that stuff. They know about me. I've got credibility in that space, right? Which, you know, a lot of people don't. But yeah, there were some awful things going on back then. But I think everybody's life
yeah,
is like that,
I
right?
Mean, I mean, to an extent, I think everybody has those moments, especially when they may be at a younger age.
Yeah, it's just some ended up on Wiki and some didn't, right?
Right.
But it doesn't mean that some of them aren't worth being
right.
on Wiki. I mean, there were people that have had much worse things happen than I had happened to
Let me ask you, I mean, because, you know, I think that drug addiction and diving into the excess seems to go hand in hand with rock musicians. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that we see more often? Is it just because people are reporting on it? Or is it something else? The idea that, like you mentioned, this high octane life where you live it for 2 hours and the other 22 hours you're lost.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, what do you think it is about being a celebrity or being a rock star and drug addiction go hand in hand?
Well, I think at some point the danger is that you wake up and realize what a hollow existence it is, right? And you say, look, you know, there. All the things that have become accolades really have no value, right? And unless you're prepared to take it back to your relationship with your instrument, which is a sacred space, and say that my life is going to be rooted in this relationship, that's really the only way to be an artist. You can't be an artist being reliant on peripheral metrics, because once you start relying on peripheral metrics that are quantifying your existence from outside, you're going to be second-guessing and re-second-guessing
right.
your
like
own
that.
Value,
right.
Right?
Right. right?
And that's, you know, that's a big danger that I see. And not just in the music business now. I mean, I live in the burbs, right? I live in Riverwoods. You know, I live in a very small hamlet. But even there, I mean, drugs and illiteracy or anti-intellectualism or whatever you want to call it is rampant in this country. It's gone beyond rock star, because now kids live in a world that's cataloged, it's hierarchical, it's quantified by things that aren't real. So you could argue now that kids on Snapchat and Twitter are experiencing more of a rock star life than rock stars ever
yeah,
were, because
right.
they're more exposed
yeah.
or just as exposed as we were. So you can see that same causal effect that we were suffering from in the 90s when I was on, you know, there's a 9-foot picture of me on Tower Records. I couldn't go anywhere in Chicago without my own velvet rope. I mean, we didn't, you know, we had the key to the city, basically, wherever we went. I mean, kids are experiencing that same thing, or at least trying to experiencing
that
through social media.
Yeah.
There's this kind of false God, false prophet, false quantification of an existence that's not rooted in something real, right? So for me, it all goes back to, and you ask my wife, ask my kids, it all goes back to my relationship with my instrument. I get up in the morning and I practice. It's like a Zen, Buddhist, monk type of existence. But I know after all of that pain and suffering that my relationship with my instrument is what defines me.
Jimmy Chamberlain's my guest, the drummer for Smashing Pumpkins. We're talking music, we're talking life, career, also philosophy here. You talk about relationship with your instrument. You talked about relationship with your family. Let's talk about relationship with the band. In 2017, where are you at with Billy Corgan and James?
Yeah, good. We're having lunch on Wednesday.
Great.
Yeah, we're, I mean,
that's
we're
great to hear.
Yeah, we're still, you know, I mean, him and I have done so many things together.
Yeah.
And we've written, you know, so many songs. And, you know, we know that when we get together to play music, good things happen. That stuff's never been, we've never questioned.
Is it hard? I mean, is it hard to have a relationship with someone that, bandmates, and I think of all the bandmates of Smashing Pumpkins, where you're riding the same roller coaster you just explained to us, the high octane, the hollowness of it. Is it hard to have a strong bond relationship with a band when all of you are going through that?
Well, again, I mean, I would say even the same about our relationship today, right? The 2 hours that we spend playing music together is the greatest thing in the world. It's the other, you know, 22 hours of the day that, you know, him and I are, you know, he's got opinions, I got opinions. We're both grown men, right?
Yeah.
You know, somebody, we're talking about playing next year with the band, and somebody asked me, you know, what's it like, you know, trying to coordinate that? I said, it's like Grumpy Old Men 3, only there's four grumpy old men and one's a woman. So, I mean, you know, that's how it's gotten to be,
right.
You know, later on when we're all kind of crotchety.
I don't want to do that.
What's your, what? You know, so, you know, again, Darcy, I think, summed it up the best when she said, when they asked her, well, just an insanely rude and misogynistic question, where they said, what's it like being a girl in a band, or a girl in the Smashing Pumpkins?
Right.
And she said, it's like being married to three guys you wouldn't even date. So I think that's the best answer. But again, I mean, you know, musically, we've never been at odds. I mean, I don't think I can honestly say that. Since 1988, I don't think Billy and I have ever argued about music, not one time. I mean, I can't think of one time where I played something and he was like, what? Or he played something and I was like, oh, don't, you know. Our musical relationship is that intact.
That's great.
Which is, you know, even when I came back to do the Manson tour in 2016, you know, we hadn't played since 2007. I mean, you're talking about going out and doing 18,000 people. We rehearsed for 5 days. That was it. And by
you just
2 days,
pick each other up.
And
yeah,
after 2 days, we were ready to rock. I mean, it's, you know, it's just in your DNA.
You know, I think about all the success that the Smashing Pumpkins had. I mean, one of the most successful American bands of all time. And I think now, and I think about what was the recipe for that success? I mean, the idea of heavy radio play.
Work.
The idea of, I mean, even beyond the art and what you guys did, but all the things that went into making a band something in the 90s or even 2000s. Do you think that there are the same opportunities for bands coming up to have this sort of meteoric careers that the Smashing Pumpkins had now that radio is different and the internet has replaced the music business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't think that ever goes away. I think the mechanism changes and the content, you know, the consumption habits change and the culture changes. But, you know, music, I mean, will always have a place at the table. I mean, it may be, you know, the plates get bigger or the plates get smaller, but there's also, you know, there's always a place at the table. I think it's an exciting time for music. I think, you know, obviously, look, when MTV came out and we thought, oh, man, we're not the greatest looking band and now we got to go make videos. And we turned it into a force multiplier for ourselves.
Right.
And I think, you know, it takes a little bit more work and a little bit more work than everybody else is doing. But it isn't anything different than goes on in my life. I mean, I know, like, to be a member of the Smashing Pumpkins or to be a member of the Jimmy Chamberlain band or Frank Catalano or the Complex, whatever, I've got to get up and practice. Because it's like when people say, what was it that made you guys so good? It's like in spite of all that addiction and drinking, we worked 6-7 days a week. We played from noon.
It's a discipline,
We got to the studio at noon, hook or crook, and played all day. And that goes on today. I mean, I know, like, at least for me to feel good about what I'm doing, it takes a tremendous amount of work. And I think, you know, when it was easy, you know, you saw the quality of the music, or, you know, obviously that's mm-hmm. subjective, but in my opinion, you know, those things went downhill. You know, now that some of the economics have been ripped out of music, I mean, it's only people that are willing to sleep in their car, which is great news for me, the music fan. I want another Dylan.
So you, as someone who not only is a musician, but even as an entrepreneur, helping young musicians navigate, the constant is the work ethic. The constant is the discipline. The constant is the what's it going to take for you to be able to produce your music?
Yeah, it's really like, you know, retirement is for people that hate their jobs. You know, it's the difference between an occupation and a vocation, right? An occupation is something you do for somebody else. A vocation is something you do for yourself. If music isn't your vocation, mm-hmm. you're going to go away. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Right.
I mean, so Michael Jordan, right? Basketball was his vocation. There's no doubt about it. You know, Patrick Kane, I mean, you look around at anybody who's been able to achieve at that high of a level, it's not their job. It's their life.
You're about to, as you just mentioned, I mean, the band get back together for a run next year. What do you have to do to prepare for something like that? Because like
nothing.
You said, nothing. No? I mean, but I don't even mean the music. I mean the idea that you're now going to do the same thing. You're going to go out on a tour. You're going to get back together. You're going to play in front of audiences. You know, you're going
to
have a strained time relationship with your family. What do you have to do to prepare yourself, Jimmy Chamberlain, to go through the motions of another Smashing Pumpkins tour?
Really nothing that I don't do now. Yoga, meditation, you know, I mean, those types of things. Prayer, I mean, you know, the things that I wasn't doing before. Again, you know, it's really, for me at this point, you know, June, I just turned 53 a couple days ago. I'm healthier than I've ever been. I feel like I'm in better shape than I've ever been. I'm playing better than I ever have. You know, for me, I have an understanding that the most valuable thing that I have is my time. So if I go through my life with that as my maxim, then I'm always going to be maximizing that time. And it's not predicated or quantified by economics. It's mostly quantified by time with my children, right?
Yeah.
Because I know, having been through that roller coaster of I'm a millionaire, I'm not a millionaire, I'm a multimillionaire, I'm not a multimillionaire. I mean, one of my mentors told me a few years ago, well, when I left the band in 2009, and there was some talk about, you know, leaving money on the table, a good friend of mine whose parents were Holocaust survivors said, I said, what do you think? And he said, look, Jimmy, he goes, I remember talking to my dad. I don't remember the couch I was sitting on. I mean, that's all you really need to know about, you know, you, your kids, your wife. So for me, I try to keep that in mind. But again, I mean, so when I ask myself, look, this music has an extremely high value to me. It's an extremely big part of my life. Do I want to go celebrate that music? Hell yeah. It's super fun. Do I want to potentially record some more music? Hell yeah. It's super fun. When Billy and I get together, amazing things happen. We've written some of the, in my opinion, and not selfishly, but some of the greatest rock songs of all time, right? Man. And they're not perfect, and they've got, you know, when I listen to them, I make faces, But again, I mean, they're honest representations of where we were at. They're documentations of where those people were at that time. And that, for me, is exciting. But as you get older, you know, you trade constitution for wisdom, right?
It's so true,
man. As we all do.
Yeah, right.
But again, you realize that wisdom is more valuable than constitution, because constitution will only allow you to kill yourself. Wisdom will prevent you from killing yourself.
Jimmy Chamberlain, my guest tonight, the longtime Smashing Pumpkins drummer, also a CEO, an entrepreneur, a jazz musician. Jimmy Chamberlain, thanks so much for being my guest tonight.
Great to be here. Yeah.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, 10 o'clock hour, playing the worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Lou Malnati's Pizzas. It's worth it. 312-981-7200. You know what's the worst, Pete? Jogging. Like, I've just lost all interest in jogging. Like, I'll do the fast walk. I can't do the jogging. No, you don't agree, Pete?
No, we mock the fast power walkers at the gym.
I'm a power walker. And I wouldn't even say power walker. I'm just a walker. I wouldn't even say. And I always have in the back of my head that if someone's going to judge me at the gym, if they're going to come up and say something that would be judgmental about me walking, I always act as if I'm ready with a response that, like, I'm recovering from an accident. You know, like, like they can't get me on. I'm really not doing anything for my health by just walking, but I'm like, I have bad knees. You know, I have hypertension.
You should put a fake brace on it like Mike Brady did, you know.
Wouldn't be a bad idea. A fake brace would work. Yeah. So that's coming 10 o'clock tonight. What's the worst? 312-981-7200. All right. Well, it's that time of year where we ask the big questions, the life-affirming questions. You ready? How's your garden holding up? That's right. Back in studio tonight, our download garden guru, Jacob Burns from the Chicago Botanic Garden. Talk about water, annuals, perennials, pruning, and my godforsaken hydrangeas. Jacob is a curator of perennials at the Chicago Botanic Gardens. He's here to solve all of our problems. 312-981-7200. If you got a question for Jacob, you can call, you can text. We have the hour to talk about gardening. Jacob, great to see you. Thanks for coming back in.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, so where are we at in the system? Because, you know, we had kind of planned about doing something in the spring, which would have made a lot of sense. But, I mean, there still are a lot of issues when it comes to gardens, flowers, vegetables, everything that's going on in people's backyards, front yards, foyers, and in my case, little strip of land that I call in front of the front door.
Yeah, I mean, spring's a busy time for everyone in the garden, but then summer is more of a time where you're coddling everything that you've, you know, planted and making sure it doesn't dry out.
Yep.
And make sure it's fertilized and make sure you're finishing up some of the pruning that you need to be doing. So yeah, there's always stuff to be doing this summer.
Well, it seems like this is the time of year, especially when you hit the hot weather, that you recognize whether or not your grandiose plan, a plan in which you set out maybe in April, where you're saying May, where you're like, this is what it's going to look like, that you start to recognize whether or not it's going to look that way. Or in case of gardens and vegetables, whether or not things are actually growing like the package said it's supposed to. I mean, is that accurate to say that this is a time where you can start to sort of see your grand plan kind of come to fruition?
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends. All plants are different. So some are, you know, they might not do anything in the spring. They bloom only in the summer, or they only bloom in the fall. So that's the thing about a garden, is it's always constantly changing if you have enough stuff in it. But certain plants, yeah, you, after a while, you might be like, is it going to do anything?
Yeah.
Like your hydrangeas, for instance.
And you had to bring up a sore spot. Okay, so let's start right there, since this is the download with Justin Kaufman, Justin Kaufman's Gardening Problems. That's the name of the segment. All right, so I've complained a lot on the show about rabbits. I have to say, thanks to your advice and others, we talked about the last time we were on, you said when you plant in the spring, it's important to take care of the precautionary methods at that point, right? That's the idea, that like, do it right away. Don't let them get a taste of it and then try to do it. Because last year, like in August, I tried to catch up and they were just jumping over the stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. At that point, they've already developed a hunger for it.
They don't care what you spray on it. Well, yeah. I'm happy to say, and a lot of people ask me today about my rabbit problem, and it's non-existent. I did all the work. We put echinacea in. We put marigolds in. We sprayed it with a deer repellent. We put up fencing in certain areas. And I think the rabbits got the memo.
Congratulations.
So we've had no rabbit problems, but here's the problem I do have.
Uh-huh.
I have three hydrangea plants that we bought last year when we started our sort of journey into gardening. All three of the plants bloomed last year. They went through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, all three of the plants are just green plants. There are no bulbs. There are no pretty pink balls. There are no anything. It's just blue. And we're trying to figure out where the bulbs are because nothing came up. I've had people tell me the theory, well, you know, hydrangeas are every other year in some cases. I've heard, oh, maybe you pruned them too much, like that kind of thing. And I'm getting getting mixed messages on what's happening with these very expensive hydrangeas. Jake.
So the hydrangea, like you already said, it was pink or blue.
It's pink.
Yeah. So a majority of those that you buy at the store, I can't say for sure which cultivar you have, but most of those are of the species Macrophylla, Hydrangea Macrophylla. Those are the pink and blue ones. And when you... In Chicago, they're not reliably hardy here. So what you'll do is you'll, you know, plant it when it's beautiful in flower. When you buy it, it looks so great because it's been growing in a greenhouse and kept warm all winter. But then you plant it here in Chicago. And then what happens is the stems that are supposed to have the flower buds for next year, they freeze off. And when those freeze off, you don't get flowers the next year because they bloom on old wood. And the old wood freezes. But there are, but it's not going to help your hydrangeas, but there are some other cultivars now that do bloom on the new wood, meaning that if that old wood freezes, it's going to push out new growth anyway and still get flowers.
What, I mean, in the case I have right now, I have three green plants, right?
Yeah, they're going to look like really lush green plants.
But they're going to stay that way. So this kind of, the idea that they already froze off, even if next winter is 70 degrees all the way through, the hydrangeas are just going to be green plants for the rest of their time?
No, I mean, if we have a super mild winter, some of those buds might make it. You could coddle the heck out of it if you wanted to and like wrap some burlap around it and try to keep it nice and warm all winter.
Come on, man. So essentially what you're telling me is that I have two options. One, to enjoy lush green plants. Mm-hmm. Or what do? Dig them up?
I think you should replace them with a cultivar that actually survived.
Can I roll up to the high-end flower store with just a green, like pulled out of the dirt and be like, drop it on the counter and be like, what's this? You think they'll be sympathetic to my...
Maybe if there's a warranty on that plant you had, you could take it back and be...
And all joking aside, I mean, do florists, are they up front with customers that way? Especially in the Chicago area, in the Midwest, where... You know, you get this thing and it says it's a perennial, it's a plant that'll continue to grow every spring. I mean, are they upfront about that?
Not if you bought it at like a box store, like hardware type place. Right. no names mentioned. Right. But if you go to like a local nursery where there's more expert staff, they'll usually not even bother to carry that particular plant because they know that they're going to get complaints later. There is a couple cultivars that if you really want a blue or a pink hydrangea that you could buy. There's one called Bloomstruck. Okay. There's a couple other ones that aren't coming to my mind. But Bloomstruck is one that is known to flower on new and old wood. So if that older wood freezes, it'll still push out some flower buds the next year. Also, you could get, if the color white is okay for you, you could get an Annabelle hydrangea, which is actually a cultivar of a native hydrangea, and it has giant, big white, ball flowers on it. And that one's reliably hardy and blooms. Whether you could cut it to the ground in the middle of winter, and it'll still come up the next year and put out a ton of flowers. So,
well, it sounds like this is the end of the segment. I think that's the end of the show tonight. We're just going dead air. We'll just play some of the Smashing Pumpkins for the rest of the hour and a half. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you got questions for Jacob Burns, he's the director of perennials at the Chicago Botanic Garden. He's got the answers for you. We've got some questions about knockout rose trees. We also have... question about hydrangeas. We also have perennials in window boxes. People on the line as well. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Jacob in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Jacob Burns in studio tonight. We're talking gardens. He, of course, is a curator of perennials at the Chicago Botanic Garden. He's here to solve all of our problems. He's already solved my hydrangea problem. I'm not sure it was the right answer, but that's okay. I don't want to hear. All right, let's start. Got a lot of texts in tonight about gardening. 847, Ed and Juliet says, what are the best perennials for window boxes in our area? And Juliet, so I guess he means the Midwest area. What do you think, Jacob?
So, yeah, I did, one thing about perennials in containers and window boxes is a lot of them, a lot of perennials only bloom for a few weeks. So if you are going to put it in a window box or container, you might, you know, only get a short period of flowers out of it, depending on which perennial it is. But there are a few that do bloom for a long time, and some of them just have beautiful foliage. Mm-hmm. Some of them just have great structure. So I think, and this is for a window box, you mm-hmm. said. So it depends on if it's in the sun or the shade. But if it was like a sunny window box, you could always put if there's a geranium, not like your peel. So there's a difference between pelargoniums and geraniums. The typical like houseplant looking ones have the bright red or pink flowers.
Right,
those they call those geraniums, but they're actually pelargoniums, and they're not perennials. There are perennial geraniums, which are hardy geraniums.
Those work?
Yeah, these types of geraniums, there's one called Roseanne, and it's got these beautiful purple flowers with kind of a white center, mm-hmm. and it blooms for months. It's already blooming now and will continue to go till fall. And it kind of spills and trails, too, so that could be good in a window box. Okay. And if you have a shady situation, you could do... Lamium, which is also called dead nettle, which is a scary name, but it's got beautiful, like, silvery foliage.
I'm down with that. I like that. Yeah. Dead nettle.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a hardcore plant name, right?
Yeah, so any perennial work in a container, I would just pick one that is ultimately going to have some interesting foliage
okay.
after it's done blooming.
So, 708 says, I planted lilies last year, and they never came back. If there anything I can do, they were pink blooms that's a different one. And they said that it's daylilies.
Oh, they are daylilies. Okay.
Yeah, daylilies, and they never came back.
That's interesting. So with daylilies, they're pretty indestructible. So I'm wondering if something ate it. Deer love daylilies. Rabbits love daylilies.
rabbits.
Another thing is if it was planted in a location that was too wet.
Oh, they don't. Lilies don't do well with.
Daylilies don't like a lot of wetness, especially like in the winter time. If the soils don't drain well in the winter, then they can go through these fluctuations of freezing and rotting, and yeah, it's not good.
Well, I mean, that asks the question just about watering in general. I mean. Yeah, obviously it's summertime, it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about it, and I'm sort of I got a routine going where it seems like I jump out every morning, you know, and water everything mm-hmm. in my front. Is that the right way to do things? I mean, should I be watering more, less? When it comes to watering in the summer of your garden and your plants and flowers, what's the course of action?
So when it comes to watering, I don't recommend that people rely on a schedule, because I think ultimately you want to water the plants when they need it. Then the best way to tell if they really need it is to do either stick your finger in the soil or take a little trowel and dig down in the soil a couple inches. And if you can tell that the soil is not dry and, you know, sandy and falling apart, then you can tell there's still moisture in the soil. Then you know that you don't need to water right away. But if it's dry in those first couple inches, then mm-hmm. that's when you definitely need to put some water down. The problem with just watering on a constant routine, like saying I'm going to water every Monday,
right.
The problem is that, you know, we could get rain and then you're overwatering the plant, or you could, you know, not water enough. And so if you only give it like a sprinkling of water, those roots are going to learn to just sit at the top of the soil and they're not going to go deep to get any other additional water. So those roots just sit at the top of the soil and then they dry out quicker. So when you water, you want to water them deeply, and you want to make sure that the entire root system of every plant is deeply watered. And then that way the roots will go down and then that way the roots has more of a root system. So that way when the top few inches of soil dry out, the plant's not going to be wilting.
Man, I am doing it all sorts of wrong. I feel like, and there's a couple of questions coming in about rabbits as well. We'll get to those. 312-981-7200. I'm new at this. I feel like I'm somewhat enlightened by having the opportunity to talk to not only you but the listeners about gardening. But man, this stuff is hard. I think I have a space that's about the size of the board in front of me, the engineering board, which is a very small space. But maybe I just need to hire a gardener and just have him come out and do it. You know, that'd be like the laziest, yuppiest thing to ever do, right? I had a gardener come out for my one little window box.
People do smart. It.
All right, Jacob Burns in studio tonight. He is the curator of perennials at the at the Chicago Botanic Garden. We're taking your calls and texts on gardening questions for the summer. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. It's the download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Jacob Burns. He's the curator of perennials at the Chicago Botanic Gardens. We're talking flowers, gardens, vegetables, grass. I mean, we could talk grass, I guess. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Kathy on the line. Kathy, thanks for calling in. How's your garden?
Oh, hi, Justin. It's actually lacking a flower, and I was wondering if Jacob would have any insight on the bearded iris that I planted. I had transplanted them from, this would be the third home I had. Had them up in my house in Wisconsin. When I moved from there, I dug up a few bulbs and put them in a townhome I was in for a few years, and they bloomed beautifully. And when I sold that, I dug up a couple more bulbs and planted them in my last residence where I'm living now. They did bloom. They bloomed for a couple of years, and for the past 2 years, there's been nothing.
Like, it's fine. I feel your pain, Kathy. I feel the same as my hydrangeas. But all right, Jacob, what do you think of that?
Well, irises are notorious for needing division. They kind of peter out after a couple years. So it sounds like you've moved around a lot, and so you may have split them up several times. But if they have been in this current home for a while, they might be, it might be time to divide them again. Also, light could be a factor. Are they getting full sun? Because they do love full sun.
You got full sun on them?
They never came out of the ground.
Oh, there just was no leaves or anything. Interesting.
Nothing came out, yeah.
But they looked fine going into winter?
Actually, it's been about 2 years. The first couple years they bloomed, and then nothing came up out of the ground for the last 2 years.
Oh, then yeah, they're nothing. Probably long gone then, unfortunately.
I got a couple of duds.
What could have happened is either moving them stressed them out, maybe they didn't get enough water, or there is an insect. It lays its larva in the root of an iris called an iris borer. That could have attacked the plant too. I guess at the time you probably would have noticed the foliage declining and looking really sad. But if you do ever see that, dig it up and pull the root apart, and you'll see a gross one in there.
Oh,
Kathy, I feel for you.
Well, there are day lilies blooming next to them, and they're come up every year, so the bugs wouldn't get at those. Huh? Yeah.
No, those are pretty pretty resilient. Deer and rabbits like them, though.
Right. All right, thanks, Kathy. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Oh man, we should have a moment of silence for those bearded irises, right? All right, good. Moving on. 312-981-7200. All right, let's keep going. I got some texts here as well. I have two lilac plants due to not bloom anymore in the spring, 815 says. Lilac plants, huh? What do you know about those?
Yeah, well, those are a shrub. They bloom in the spring. They smell great. Everyone loves those. I guess the thing that we should consider if they're not blooming is, one, light. They like full sun. So if they're in too much shade, they're probably not going to produce flowers as much. Also, lilacs can get as they age the each trunk, because they're usually a clump of different multiple stems. Those stems can get older and wear out, wear themselves out. And so what you have to do is rejuvenate them. And so those thicker, older stems that aren't really producing a lot of flowers anymore, what you do is in like February or March, cut it down to like 4 to 6 inches, prune out all those bigger, thicker ones. You'll probably have some smaller ones in there, and those are the ones you want to save because those are younger shoots.
Wow.
And those are the ones that will fill back in and produce nice flowers.
Wow. I had no idea. Lilacs sound hard. All right. 312-981-7200. Let's move on to knockout rose trees. 847 says, my knockout rose tree was pink bloom last year. This year, no blooms. I used Osmotico. How do you say that?
Osmocote.
Osmocote 2 months ago. And then in all caps, what is up? Randall.
Well, yeah, so Osmocote, if anyone's not familiar, is a slow release fertilizer that comes in these little like plasticky pellety ball things that you can just sprinkle them on top of the soil, and they just slowly release the fertilizer, and it lasts like 4 to 6 months, and you don't risk burning the plants by adding too much fertilizer. It's just the perfect amount. But the problem is roses are heavy feeders. They love lots of fertilizer. And so the Osmocote might actually be too slow of a release of a fertilizer.
They want more.
So, yeah. So what he could do is continue to have the Osmocote, but then maybe like I don't know if this is in a container or in the ground either. So it varies. But what he could also do is mix up some of the liquid fertilizer. It's like liquid soluble fertilizer, and you mix it with water that you can actually pour over the plant, and it will absorb it through the leaves and through the roots. Okay. Once it hits the ground, and it's quick,
right?
And you have to apply it like every couple weeks, so he could do that to give it some instant nutrients.
Pouring the fudge over the ice cream.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, there you go. 815 says, just got in the car, heard you talking about rabbit problems in the garden. Yes, but didn't catch it all. We have two labs. What can we do to put on our veggie plants? What can we put on our veggie plants that'll keep the rabbits out but won't harm the dogs scent-wise? Thanks for any help that you can provide. Scent-wise. So, I mean, the dogs don't like... I would assume it'd be just chemicals. Like, what do we want to put on there so they don't eat bad stuff, but...
Yeah, I don't know. Are the dogs allergic to certain smells? I'm not sure, but I know that, like, the whole point of organic repellents is the smell. That's what keeps the rabbits away, and the taste. So I don't know what
doesn't hurt really the dogs.
It doesn't. Yeah, the organic repellents won't hurt the dog because they're not chemicals. But they're definitely
like
going to smell bad. Yeah. So if they're worried about smell, then yeah, they're going to smell. But what they could put on the around the vegetables is blood meal, and that's something that rabbits don't like. And it's
blood meal.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's like dry.
That's what you get. Is that the dry, like the powder kind of thing?
Dried blood is what it is. I know it's gross. But that's what you put around the plant, and the rabbits hate it.
Is that the stuff you gave me last year? That was like, I put something on the in August or whatever. And the next day, there's just flies everywhere. Like, there's just like, I don't know if the rabbits weren't gone. The rabbits may have been gone for a day, but the flies had returned. And I was like, all right. This is what it's going to be for the rest of my time in gardening, like fending something off and inviting something new. Before I let you go, the pruning. Let's talk about pruning, because this is another issue where this is the part that I just don't understand as a rookie gardener, as someone who puts the stuff in, and I did great work with soil and the mulch and all that kind of stuff, looking good, everything looks good. But I have to actually prune some of these perennials to make them grow the next year too? I mean, I have to do extra work. How's that work?
Well, this is so the process of getting certain plants to rebloom is called deadheading. And that's basically when the flower is past its prime.
Mm-hmm.
What flowers usually do is they go into seed forming mode. So they're going to try to produce seeds. So what you want to do is cut that flower part off before it has a chance to produce seed, because it's going to put all its energy into that seed and not making more flowers. So if you cut off the spent flowers before it goes in the seed, the plant will push more energy into putting out more flowers. And even if the plants don't rebloom, they'll at least put more energy into its foliage and its root system. So you'll have a healthier plant if you don't let it go to seed.
And in terms of pruning, I mean, it's time to essentially finish the pruning for the spring trees and shrubs, right? Like, this is the time to do that?
Yeah, so, like, going back to, like, the lilac, any shrub that blooms in the spring, lilacs, viburnums, forsythias, things that most people have in their gardens. If you want, if you need to do any sort of pruning on those, you want to do those. Definitely want to get that done like this weekend. You want to have it,
right?
Yeah, you want to have it done by like the 1st of July. Because what happens is what happens is those plants, when you prune them, the kind of like with the hydrangea scenario, like those plants, you prune them and then they push out a little more growth. And that growth is what has to produce the flower buds for next year. But if you wait too long, those, that pushes out that growth, and then you wait too long to cut it, you're cutting off all the potential flower buds for next year. So what you want to do is do it now.
Could I have made that mistake with my hydrangea?
Did you prune it?
Did, yeah. My wife did. But pruned it probably late. Like, I would think that we pruned...
Then maybe it wasn't even winter. Maybe it was just you that just ruined the flowers on your hydrangea.
Well, to be fair, I mean, my wife. Let's not, come on now.
Yeah.
You don't think that I didn't throw shade already? Like, it's the one area that I could throw shade. Where she said, I think I pruned these at the wrong time. And I gave a little look like, hey, I know what's going on. Why are you messing with my garden?
Yeah, so, those hydrangeas in
they
particular.
Need to, any hydrangea, anything, July 1st is really where you want to be when you're pruning, because you want to give it enough time to do whatever it has to do.
Yeah, anything that blooms in the spring or early summer, you want to like prune those as soon as possible, because they have to have time to develop those flower buds on the new growth that does still come out.
Right.
But if you prune them late, you're going to cut off all that potential flower buds for next year. But other shrub, like hedges or shade trees, like non-blooming hedges, like boxwoods, privets, you can prune those all the way up to like August 1st.
Okay.
But you don't want to prune after August 1st, because there's another situation where if you prune them after August 1st, that growth that they flush out after won't have time to harden off before winter sets in, and then you end up with dieback in winter.
Hmm. What do I do with chia pets? That's different, completely different. That's the one that's growing. We'll just let that one go. Jacob Burns joins us regularly here on The Download. He is the curator of perennials at the Chicago Botanic Garden. So what I learned today is probably watering wrong. Did a good job, though, with the rabbits, although, there's still a long way to go here. Rabbits are – my theory is that there's a lot right now, like in all the yards and everything, so they're good. And then you get to the later times, like August – and that's where they're like, we're running out of food. What do we got over here? That's what I'm worried
about.
And they
can like produce multiple, like, what are they? Are they called litters? I don't even know what they're called. But they produce multiple crops.
So there'll be more.
Crops of rabbits every year. So.
Yeah, so I'm still, do you think that I should probably do all of the stuff again? Like, should I like try to spray everything and do everything coming up here before?
If you know they're in your area, like if you're walking down the street and you see them, yeah, then I would just continue to keep putting stuff on those plants. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Also, I learned that I'm probably pruning wrong. I'm probably gardening wrong. I'm probably doing everything wrong. That's what I learned today. Jacob, great to see you. Thanks for coming in, buddy.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Download here on 720 WGN. Good to catch up. Jacob Burns. I like that guy. I also like that I'm just pretty much blatantly called out for my lack of gardening know-how. And I blame this on you, Download Nation. I've been talking about hydrangeas and bunnies, and if you couldn't tell that I was a novice, that I was doing it wrong, I mean, I count on you. I count on the people who send me pictures of their gardens or they tell me what's up or, what's going on with their space, encouraging me. Say, Justin, you're pruning at the wrong time. This is what you got to do. You're pruning wrong.
I'm sure it's rewarding and it's fun. And it's great to see all that, but it's awesome. It sounds like a
well, here's my problem. Yeah, my problem. And I think this is probably a cultural problem, like a me generation.
Mm-hmm.
Is you do a lot of hard work in your garden, and you spend a couple days, maybe not even a couple hours. We might talk about a couple days, and half of that I'm not even doing anyway. And you're sort of you got like gloves on, you're digging into the soil, you can scrape up your knees a little bit,
yeah.
Everything gets dirty, and you do the work, and the flowers look real pretty, and you go out there and you're like, this is great. And then the concept or the idea that you have to do it again to keep it going, nah.
Yeah,
you
lose interest.
You know
interest.
What I mean? That's where I lose interest. That's where I'm like, I'm sitting out there and I got my feet up and I'm like, this is great. And if the marigold's not, or the hydrangea's not pruned right, you know what? Sue me. I don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry. I can only go so far. I'm a novice gardener at best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm even more of a novice when it comes to crock potting. You know, that's the other thing that I've taken on, and that's not a summer thing. And that's another one where I'm like, it just got too hard. Like, and that's the easiest form of cooking. You just put a bunch of stuff in a pot and you turn the timer to 6 hours. And I thought that was too much work. Like, I think the problem I'm having right now is that I'm taking on these pursuits that are really about, I mean, they really are at the end of the day, they're this moment of zen where you can be like, oh, I made this food, this nourishment for me. You know, or I built this garden around to help me think or to, you know, help with the oxygen level in my front little foyer, you know, to cancel out the loud cars that are around, whatever. All that's great on paper, but you get to a certain point where you're like, yeah, I just kind of want to drink this beer, read this book about Vietnam, chill out, and I'll prune tomorrow, right? So I don't know. Maybe I just need to, like everybody else, just get more into video games. Because then you have to do much, you know. But don't get me wrong. There's a lot of pruning in video games. You've got to make sure you got the, if you're playing a football game, you got to make sure your team's right. It's the same concept.
Yeah.
I guess the lesson here for everybody listening in Michigan Avenue is that you can't skip the pruning. You know, no matter where you're at in life, what you're doing, whatever it is, work, play, flowers, whatever it is, can't skip the pruning. That's what I learned tonight. You agree?
Yeah. Yeah. I tend to avoid all types of gardening at the house.
You have a communal garden, right?
Well, no. This year,
you got rid of it?
We got rid of it because we have an area now for a garden.
Oh, that's right. Well, you switched houses.
Yeah,
right,
so
right.
We didn't do one this year just because it was too late, but... Yeah.
Do you have the room in the new house? I mean, is there a yard in the back that you can do stuff?
Spot.
Are you going to do stuff?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You want me to come over and show you how it's done? I could come over and show you guys a little bit what I know about hydrangeas. I mean, everything Jacob said, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Me, the novice gardener, he knows what's up.
I'm just happy that when we eventually get a garden and we grow vegetables, we won't have strangers stealing our tomatoes because we have a backyard now that's, you know, we can lock it up because at the community garden,
people taking
I
hate
tomatoes.
To burst your bubble, but they'll just jump your fence and steal your tomatoes anyway. That's city living. Or the possums. The possums will get it.
We rode our bikes by the old community garden like last week, and it was like sure enough, there's a gypsy out there with her.
Someone just in there taking stuff?
Just taking everybody's tomatoes or vegetables or whatever.
That's not okay.
Yeah. I wanted to call the police, but I didn't think that would be appropriate.
911. What's your problem, sir? There's a lady. I don't think that she belongs to the communal garden. And she's got a bag, and it's a burlap sack type thing from Trader Joe's. And she's taking all the cucumbers, all the tomatoes. Can you get two squad cars over here right away?
I was thinking, I wonder if she's from a local restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
She, like, advertised. We get these right from local farms. We're so local.
That's my new restaurant concept, stealing from farm to table. See, what I do is I go to local farms. I only steal from local farms. I only jump local fences to steal local produce. That's what you get here at my farm to table restaurant. That's perfect. All right, playing the worst coming up here on the download, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. Are we ready to have some fun tonight? Let's complain about the worst things in society for prizes. It's coming up here on the download. Stay with us.
It's going down.
Thank you, Rob. It's download here on 720 WGN, and tonight it's time for the worst. This is where we complain about the worst things in society. For prizes, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text. You can also Call in the number 312-981-7200. In studio tonight, two judges from the local comedy community, Mary Novohosky. Mary, good to see you.
Good to see you too. It's great to be back on the air.
That's right. Good to see you. Mary, of course, is a comedian. She's going to be doing the show Ladylike at Cafe Mustache on July 17th. And in studio as well is Dave Metz. Stan, hey. How you doing, Dave? Good to see you.
Hey.
He does the podcast Palm Pilots, which is about pornography. It's good.
Yeah, you know.
Clever. And they both together do the music podcast, Impress Me With Music, which is on iTunes, just launched today. Both of you, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, Mary, you ready? You've known this. All right.
I'm ready to do this.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. First, let's start with Pete Zimmerman, because we do that every single time. Pete, you want to kick us off with the worst tonight?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
Neighbors who engage.
Mm-mm.
Don't like it.
Mary doesn't like it, or you like it?
I don't like it. I don't want to know you. You know.
Same.
Mm-hmm.
Stay on your turf.
Right. Always chit-chatting.
I don't know. I like it. I like it to a certain. There are some neighbors, and I have relatives who have neighbors who do this, where it just goes way overblown. But I'm a little bit of an engager. I'm not going to lie to you. It comes from my dad. I sit in my front area by my flowers, and people walk by, and I go, "How you doing, Bob? Hey, buddy. Hey, that's a nice dog you got there." I mean, that's okay, right?
My sister and her brother-in-law, they have the stay-at-home dad across the street, you know, like Russ.
Oh, yeah, he's a Russ.
He's just always got, like, Looney Tunes pajama pants on. He's like, what are you guys doing today? What are you up to? I don't know, man. Going to work. How's your business from home going?
Yeah, you have to watch out for the follow-up questions. That's where they're going to get you.
Well, you don't want them to know too much about you, because they know where to always find you. You can never, like, blow them off. It's weird. You got to be closer to them than you are to, like, your real friends.
That's right. 312-981-7200. All right, why don't we go to the panel. Mary, what do you got for the worst?
Oh, man. Well, I just announced to the world I'm pregnant. But, you know,
congratulations.
Yeah, it's great. So there's all these beautiful things about being pregnant. But the worst is when you're not pregnant enough to make people automatically get up from the train seat to let you sit down. But you're still too pregnant to stand for 45 minutes. You know, like, you just look a little fat.
Mary, you're gonna have a rude awakening in Chicago. Oof. When you're on that train at 7 months pregnant and nobody moves. Like, it's going to be an episode of that ABC, like, oh, what would you do kind of thing.
I'm already struggling in that Jackson Pee-Pee tunnel. You know, that's hard enough for me.
Sorry. You got to walk a mile underneath downtown.
That red line transfer. I'm like, I don't think I'm going to make it here.
Chicago can be a cold, cold place. You're gonna jump on that train, and you're going to be pregnant, and they are going to be like, hey, you stand like the rest of them. I'll give you a break.
You're having a kid? Life is tough.
Yeah. Welcome to the red line.
I've never given my seat up once, ever. I swear to God. I know that makes me sound like a cruel, evil person. I've never once. I just look at my shoes. I don't look to see if people are pregnant. Are you supposed to be inspecting that when you're on the train? Oh, she looks pregnant.
You
I should
just
give
go for
her.
The unaware look. You're like, I am just I'm not at all letting people into my environment.
Yeah. I treat it like I'm in my car, and if you want to get into my space bubble, that's your problem. You know?
It's your problem. All right, Dave, what do you got for the worst?
So I think it's the worst. It's the absolute worst when people tell you to support local art. I hate that. Make your art better. Don't force me to support something. I'll support what I want to support. I'm familiar with the concept of supporting things.
It's so true. Support local art.
It's always bad art. If someone's like, you got to support this, I painted a name in spray paint on this wall. You ought to support that.
Yeah, it's like, I got an exhibit at the coffee shop. That's not an exhibit. You know the guy that owns the coffee shop.
And who prices, like, seriously, the price, like, we were looking at one time at this coffee shop in Wicker Park, and it was a doodle on the wall. It was like $900.
Wow.
Yeah, and he had the gall to write a paragraph explanation next to it. And also include his headshot. I'm like, you're not, you know, an author of a book.
His dog's name. We know the name of this guy's dog. Why?
Hey, you got to have an artist statement. You know, you always got to have a narrative. Beginning, middle, end. What happened in the middle of their career? You never know. You know, now you know, right?
Yeah. Sold paintings at a coffee shop.
There you go. 312-981-7200. Mary Novohosky and Dave Metz in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We got some people calling in text. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. All right, playing the worst here on Download 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. in studio, Dave Metz and Mary Novohovsky, and we are playing the worst. We've got a lot of texts coming in, some people on the line as well. Let's keep going here. All right. It's 331. You ready for this one?
Oh, I'm excited.
It's a good one. The worst was when I spent hours preparing a potluck dish to impress my new neighbors at a neighborhood party on Sunday. Carried the dish a couple of blocks, found no one there, and learned the party was on Saturday.
Ooh. Oh, man.
Missing, got the wrong day for the potluck.
Dementia is the worst.
That's tough. I guess it could happen, especially if it's like new neighbors.
Yeah, is that I feel like we just talked about that. It's the new neighbor. Are you that neighbor, you know? Or are you the neighbor people don't want to meet? Maybe they just changed the date on you.
Oh, yeah, then you start to get freaky head games, right?
I wonder what that potluck dish was. I mean, hopefully they got to eat it. I'm sure it was delicious.
That's the good news, right? The good news is if it was on Sunday, then you missed the party. So that's the joke, right?
Yeah.
But at least you got dinner because you can eat that dish, right?
Right. And you shouldn't really be upset because you missed a neighbor's party, and that's a mitzvah as far as I'm concerned.
All right, we got some good stuff here. You know what's the worst? A teenager who thinks everything you say should turn into an exchange. Oof. All right, that just sounds like an argument, I guess, is the idea.
Yeah, it's like a Louis C.K. B-side, that one.
Right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Teenagers, get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said about, I'm assuming, I don't have a teenager, I have a 9-year-old. Mary, at some day you will have a teenager.
I will.
And even the 9-year-old, the huffing and puffing part, you know, where you say, hey, time for bed, go brush your teeth.
I'm still huffing and puffing. You know, I feel like I'll definitely have like a huffing puffing toddler. Like my baby's first thing is just going to be, "Ugh, mom." It's my child's first word.
That'll
accompanied
be it.
By a huff. Ugh. These sweet potatoes. Ugh.
I'm also going to be huffing. Also, I'm also not going to want to do stuff.
All right.
312 says old men who wear their pants up to their breasts.
Now that's hilarious. You're wrong.
I hope to be that old man someday. You know, I would enjoy I'm assuming that there's a thrill in the idea that you yank your pants up that high, right?
I think it keeps everything up. That's why women have Spanx. It's like a man Spanx. Is when you lift the pants all the way up to just under the bosom bone, man bosom bone.
Yeah. A little
the chest,
the slack. You want to get those slacks as high as you can.
Yeah, I mean, I had a teacher in high school that didn't like the way the kids tucked in their shirts. He was an old man, so he dropped his pants in the middle of class to show us how to tuck in a shirt, and then he did it up to the nipples. Basically, that's apparently the right way. That's how they taught them in the 50s to do that.
Let's go to Bonnie. Bonnie, what's the worst, Bonnie?
Okay, I took my dog out in the morning. Mm-hmm. This was about a month ago, and I knew the landscapers had been out. I live in a building. It's for people who are 55. Mm-hmm. So we're all older people, but a lot of us can't garden anymore. So the building manager has this landscaping company, and I came out in the morning, and I thought I was seeing things because the grass was three-toned color. It was green, and they had obviously fertilized it, and they burned it, the grass. The grass was orange and yellow.
Orange, yellow, and green,
And this was about a month ago. This is when we had it really hot weather, and it was like, first we had a cold spring, and they couldn't come out any earlier to do this, so now they've tried to remedy it. A couple of weeks afterwards, they came back and they put this seed down where over the burnt grass.
Oh, jeez.
Over the burnt grass.
So it sounds like you have quite a yard there in the front.
Oh, it's very colorful, but it's beautifully landscaped. There's beautiful flowers. Yeah. I don't
garden anymore.
It's
not the worst,
but
right?
It's bad.
And then they put this webbing over it.
No, webbing's the worst.
What is webbing?
They came back and they tried a different thing this time. Then today some of the spots, they didn't do all the webbing at once. And then, of course, there's 70 residents older senior people in the building
yeah.
all complaining to the management. So they came back today, and they turned over the soil, removed some of the junky grass in new places, and then they put new dirt down, new seed, and then more new webbing. So we have different... various stages.
All right, Bonnie, that's all right. I know. I get it.
I feel like I've learned so much about the
I know. Thanks, Bonnie.
About the process.
Did they burn like a pentagram maybe into the grass? Like that would be the worst.
I think that's
what we kept waiting for, right?
That's where it was going.
Yeah, the landscaping, there's no doubt, a landscaping nightmare. The worst.
A landscaping nightmare. I did have a nightmare when I was dog sitting and everybody got their lawn sprayed with some kind of chemical and I just ignored the little yellow flag because it was like 7 a.m. and then the dog decided to eat grass and then all they did was like vomit and poop themselves for 2 hours.
That was a nightmare or that actually happened?
No, that was real.
Oh, that was real. Okay,
that was real.
I just
but then
to get
there
that
was
clear.
The webbing and...
Yeah, then...
Webbing? What is it, like Spider-Man? Or, like, I've never even...
No,
yeah,
it's like
with the webbing on
like
the grass, right?
It's a mesh kind of thing.
I've been living in apartments for like the last decade. I don't know what webbing is. I've never mowed a lawn in my entire life. I'll be completely honest with you.
You need to show Dave the world. You know, he hasn't seen webbing on grass. There's
Dave lived in China for 3 years, but he's never seen webbing. They don't have grass there, though.
Oh, yeah, so there
you
go.
Just a concrete.
All right, let's go. Jasmine, how are you, Jasmine?
I'm doing good. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
My phone sounds like it's breaking up.
No, you're good to go. What's the worst, Jasmine?
Well, today, me and one of my friends went down to the lakefront, and we had to take the train. The worst is when you're riding on the L and somebody in the same car as you thinks it's cool to play their music without earbuds.
Yeah, who does that? Yes. That is the worst.
That's the point of earbuds. And no no offense, but no one else on the train wants to listen to your crap.
Jasmine, thank you.
Watch
the language, but thank you. That's a good one. That was a good one.
Have a good rest of your night.
You too. Thanks, Jasmine.
Thanks, Jasmine.
Jasmine kind of nailed it. That may be the winner tonight, only for the fact that it always blows my mind that someone would put on speakerphone their music from their phone, that's what they're doing, and play it without earbuds on the L. That's a social tick. Someone's doing that on purpose.
I like it.
People.
No.
They're curating the train. I like that.
It's a tale as old as a cell phone. Because I remember when someone would just play their 15-second ringtone for a while, just on repeat. I remember I'd have that. Be like, we get it. You know, you got a cool ring back.
You got to let everyone know how cool you are on the train. You don't want them to think you're some punk.
No.
Yeah.
I remember the old days, and they'd say no radio playing on the L. That used to be the old thing, and because there were people bring on their boombox and play something loud on the train. But the idea of your cell phone without earbuds, just on so you can let people know how cool you are, that's a Hall of Fame worst.
Sure. But what's worse, that or the guy that like is singing on the train? Yeah, he's got his earbuds in, but he's got the spirit of the song in his heart. You know?
That is the worst, too. That's a twofer. That's a twofer. All right, let's keep going. 312-981-7200. All right, let's see. All right. Wow. 630 says the worst is when you put too much detergent in the washer at the laundromat. And then you have to face the other customers while you're mopping up soap suds all over the floor. That's pretty bad.
That's bad. Yeah.
312, long sloppy strands of dog drool all over you as your big retriever tries to backseat drive in the car.
Drool.
That's why I don't keep a dog on hand.
630 says, you know, it's the worst outdoors.
Yes.
Everything is hard.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, somebody. Oh, my gosh.
You know there's bugs out there that bite you and take your blood? I just found out about that. That's a nightmare. Why was I not warned about that?
All right, keep going. Mary's got a good one, 847. Card games on a lazy Sunday afternoon, the worst.
Card game.
That sounds like a delight. What are you talking about?
Hey, Mary, you're the worst.
Mary, no way. Mary's the best. She's all over. I vouch for Mary. She's,
all right,
she comes
great.
Up with great stuff.
Mary, I'm sorry. I take that back. I'm also a Mary.
I'll bet that if you are someone who has had card games your entire life on Sundays, and it gets to the point where that deck of cards gets pulled out at 3 o'clock on a Sunday, and it's been a routine of your family's forever.
Sure.
It would be the worst. You get to a certain point, you're like, can we just watch anything? His river monster's on. I'll watch River Monster. I don't do his card stuff anymore, right? All right, keep going here. 815 says, when you meet your daughters on Tuesday night for Father's Day, they give you a Hossa jersey. And then on Wednesday morning, you hear that Marian Hossa is out for the season.
I don't know who Hossa is.
It's a sports thing.
It's Blackhawks.
I know that. We're artistes. You know, we don't.
Oh, yeah.
This is a good story. I feel like I can mansplain.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Marian Hossa is probably a Hall of Fame hockey player.
Okay.
Who came to the Blackhawks right before the Blackhawks won their first Stanley Cup championship, came from the Red Wings, and he was a big deal, and he came and he actually brought stability to the team for 6 years. They won three championships in 6 years, the Blackhawks did. Okay, we got that? Everyone up to speed?
Yeah.
This year, he announced last week, the season hasn't started yet, that he's going to be out for the entire year next year. He's getting older. But the reason is he's got a skin condition that is essentially like an allergic reaction to the equipment.
Weird.
Isn't that weird? But it's actually something that happens a lot in hockey because they play with like really sweaty, weird stuff.
Right.
And so there's an allergic reaction. And then the actual, I guess, the whatever medicine they give for the skin is the stuff that keeps them out. Now it becomes like your skin essentially on that stuff. It hurts. Like it's like not good.
Wow.
And there's also, now there's that. I said that. And I say it in all earnestness because, yeah, if that's a serious thing, that's crazy, right?
Right.
But then also the conspiracy theory is that is a way that the hockey teams, when a player gets older and he's still on contract and he's got to be paid a lot of money under a salary cap, they say he has a skin condition. And then it's essentially so they don't have to have him retire because if he retires, the money goes against the cap. And the condition means he's out for the year, and it's not. That's the conspiracy theory.
That's very elaborate, though, the whole skin condition.
And welcome to hockey.
I didn't realize the Teamsters ran hockey. That's you give them a no-show job.
It's kind of interesting. I got to say, I mean, as far as sports drama goes, it's a pretty good one, right? Yeah. Skin conditions usually don't make it into sports injuries. So
you think someone tears something, breaks something, rips something, you're like, yeah, you know, he's got a reaction.
There was a guy on the Tigers, he had to take off a bunch of time because he hurt his thumb playing Guitar Hero.
Right, see, there you go. That's a good. There
yeah, we get, that's a good one.
The second half of the worst is going to be weird sports industry injuries. Was it Kyle Farnsworth? Who was it that hurt his hand? Broke through a glass table, like a coffee table. He like broke his coffee table at home, and it shattered glass, and he wasn't able to play. Like there's one guy like that. All right, update. Real quick update from Bonnie. You guys ready for this?
Okay, I'm ready.
So Bonnie, who was on the phone, and she kept the story going.
The webbing.
Yeah, the webbing. Actually sums it up on text, where she says, the burnt grass made my dog throw up from just walking in it. Management said it was safe for dogs, and it wasn't. That's where she was going.
That's where I thought it was going. I just felt like we were on a very long...
We were
on a journey.
It was a long journey,
we
right?
We were on a long journey. Yeah.
Bonnie was giving us a full couple days of this story.
It was like a Stephen King book. We didn't know what it was about until like 100 pages in. Oh, it's about a dog throwing up. Oh.
Exactly.
I thought it was about a prison.
Mary Novohosky and Dave Metz in studio tonight. We're playing the worst. 312-981-7200. We've got some good stuff coming up, and we will continue the second half of the worst here on the download. 312-981-7200. Before we do that, let's go to the news tonight. What do you think? What do you think of Bonnie's story, Rob? Do you think she got the first three quarters of it on the phone and she finished on text? Strong, strong storytelling tonight.
That's the worst.
It really is.
I mean, come on.
She got it done, though. I will give her credit that she was able to sum it up on text, so I give her extra points for that.
All right.
And just because of the ordeal of the story, she may actually be a front runner tonight. Just in the idea that,
she might need a pizza.
She made an impression. She made an impression on us.
What's going down, y'all?
It's a download here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Rob. We're playing the worst. Dave Metz, Mary Novohosky in studio. They do the podcast, a music podcast, just launched today. Impress Me With Music, which will be on iTunes. Also, Dave does the podcast Palm Pilots, which is really an ode to pornography. Good work on that.
Filthy. Very
Ladylike is a show that Mary's doing on stage at Cafe Mustache July 17th. Both of them in studio night tonight to play the worst. 312-981-7200. Got a lot of stuff that came in just in the break. Are you ready for this?
Oh, I'm excited.
773 says, the worst is when you order a plain cheeseburger from McDonald's and drive away only to discover that at home that they gave you two pieces of bread and only cheese.
Why are you ordering a plain cheeseburger? How boring of a person are you?
You know, because for me is when I order a cheeseburger from McDonald's and it doesn't come with anything else on it, that's when I get infuriated. I guess I can see where they're coming from.
I would
be very upset.
I would. There's no doubt. I mean,
but you got to put a pickle on there.
There's, I would say, if I got home and there was no burger in the burger,
yeah,
you know, I would be mad about it because I'd just be like, all right, this is ridiculous. They had one thing to do, and that's put the burger on the bun, right?
How far would you go to remedy that? Would you call them? Are you the kind of person that would call
calls
them?
The local McDonald's?
Dave will call. Like, we've called. Yeah. He's made me call the local Wendy's.
Let me share. I'm going to share a pro tip with everyone.
Right. He worked at a McDonald's.
I worked at McDonald's for three years.
All right, okay.
Show up at any McDonald's in America. Say that you came in yesterday. You talked to a manager, and they totally messed up your order. And then just order whatever you want, and it works 100% of the time. They don't care. They don't care about like costs. They're making millions of dollars. They don't care.
They
at
don't
all.
Care. You can say, who is the manager? Mike?
Yeah. Just make a noise. Sure. They probably don't even know. They've probably been working there for 3 days. They're going to get fired in a week. They don't even know. It's a high school kid. You think he cares? He's growing hair on his face for the first time. You think he cares whether or not you talk to a manager?
Good pro tip.
Yeah.
There you go. We're hacking life here. The McDonald's hack. All right, 506 is the worst is when married couples, or couples in general, dress up in matching outfits or wear complimentary T-shirts like "You Complete Me" or "You Suck." Right. That is the worst.
Yeah.
I'm not a big I always get a little bit freaked out when my wife and I match.
When you're too close?
Yeah, like we'll go out and it'll be like a night and she'll be have like a blue dress on and I'll come out and I'll be like wearing like maybe like a blue something and it perfectly matches. I'm like, I got to change. It can't be that couple.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to say that we've decided that once our child is born, we're all going to wear tracksuits.
Yeah, we're going to get matching tracksuits.
All right.
We're going to do matching Adidas tracksuits.
Five of them, like the Royal Tenenbaums.
So, you know? Is it the worst? Yes. Will I participate in that trend? Absolutely.
I think it's the worst if there's no kid. Because then it's like, oh, what, you love each other, you know, come on.
And it's not Halloween.
It's not Halloween.
If you match a costume for Halloween, like it's a family thing, or even a couple, then you're like, okay, I get it. But matching just in general, no. All right, I've got an update on that story. Here we go. Ready?
Bonnie?
No, not Bonnie. 773. Update. I went back in. They said I was lying.
Oh.
And I had to threaten to call corporate.
Whoa.
So they gave me my burger.
Whoa.
So they did the same thing. They.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you got to threaten people. I forgot to say that in the pro tip.
You got to threaten to call corporate, like corporate's his thing. Like they got a number to call.
I will call Ray Kroc right now.
Worse is waking up at 9 a.m. forgetting you invited five people over for breakfast until they ring your doorbell. Oh,
sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, and I don't know how I'm probably not inviting a lot of people over for breakfast.
Yeah.
Right? Like maybe like a lunch, maybe like on a holiday, dinner maybe, but breakfast, I just feel like I'm not inviting anybody over for breakfast, right?
Yeah, it's too intimate.
And 9 a.m. is still too early. Like what kind of...
Yeah, there's a lot of questions we have.
Yeah.
Right. I would like some clarification.
262 says the worst is when your phone dies right before you're supposed to pick someone up at the airport.
Ooh. That's bad. Yeah.
Oof. Yeah. What do you do in that situation?
Intercom. I've done it before. You got to go in and ask them to make an announcement.
You just got to go in and say the manager said that I could use your intercom.
Yeah, manager said that.
Corporate. I call corporate. You got to let me use this intercom right now. Tammy, it's me.
All right, here we go. All right, keep going. Let's see. All right, there's one here I want to get to because it's a second one. All right, the worst. The worst will get some very literal ones, and here's a literal one. The worst is helping a friend who gets locked up by putting money in his commissary account, visiting him while he's in jail, watching his car and other property, supporting him at his court dates, and when he gets out, he falsely accuses you of stealing from him. True story.
Isn't that the plot of the second season of Empire? That's, I don't know if that's the worst necessarily.
Yeah, I think that might be a.
I don't
know. I've never lived that life.
You never, yeah, you, don't you hate it? Like, this is a common problem we all have. Someone's abusing the commissary money you give them.
All right, good one here. 3-1-2. The worst is shedding all over the house. I finally had to tell my husband to put a shirt on. Da-doom. Yeah. 319 says the worst is when you spend $500 in groceries. Wow.
Ooh.
And half of that is cold. And you come back to find the next morning that you have groceries spoiled because the fridge stopped working.
Oh, no. Well, why were you spending $500?
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. How many people are you feeding?
I swear, I have a nervous tick. Like, that what I have to do in any grocery store situation is has to be under $100. Like,
oh,
if
really?
I get to $100 or close to it, even if it's a big order and a whole thing, I, like, start to trim back. Like, I'm just, like, I have – it's, like, a win for me. It's a mental win to keep it under 100. Today I was at Whole Foods, and I was just, like, getting closer, and I'm like, what am I going to put back?
You don't – like, there's a lot you don't need at Whole Foods. Like, you don't need turmeric juice,
you
know?
You don't tell me, man. Oh, I was shopping with my wife, and she's like, these cherries are – I'm like, no, stop. We don't need the cherries.
I can't stop myself. I can't control it. I start watching it go over 100, and it hurts me. It pains me because I know I only have like $114 in my bank, but I will let that Whole Foods bill go up to like $111.96. I'm like, well, yeah, I needed those 2 pounds of $9.99 organic Bing cherries. Yeah,
it's the cherries and the grapes,
it is,
man.
It's the cherries. Yeah. They're. Yep.
I blew all my commissary on Whole Foods last time I was in the clink, you know.
708 says the worst.
Cherries.
All
yeah.
those cherries.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the cherries are crazy. It was $8 for cherries today. It's crazy. It's a crazy amount of money for cherries.
$8. Were those like Sharper Image cherries? Like, what was so great about them? What was so nice about these cherries?
Sharper Image cherries.
All right, 708 says the worst is when you call someone to leave a message and their mailbox is full. Yeah, that is the worst. Especially cell phones. You're like, what are you doing?
Why do you need to leave voicemails? I didn't have voicemail for 3 years. I just let it be filled up because I was like, text me or try to call me again or it's not that important. That's kind of how I looked at it, which I did not get a lot of job interviews with that approach.
708 says, you know what's the worst? Uno. Can't
Uno.
Everybody play by the same rules? Oh, they're talking about Uno.
Uno.
The card game.
I've never played Uno. Maybe maybe it's some child of immigrants, but we were like, Mary, we will not play Uno in this house.
She will not be learning Spanish. Yeah. She's struggling enough with English as it is.
Please. Uno has this is absolutely right, and I agree with this caller, because Uno is one of those things where there's a little bit of wiggle room on the rules, and so every home has a different set of rules, and sometimes you don't necessarily have that figured out by the time you start playing.
Sure.
Somebody goes, oh, Yahtzee Uno, and they put like another two down, and you're like, what are you doing? And they're like, that's how you play. No, and it comes to blows.
Yeah.
And you're just like, you can't just make up rules. So I agree. I'm on the Uno train there.
I love how this guy was like, can't we all just get along? He's like a Rodney King approach to Uno. Why can't we all play by the same rules? Come on.
It's equality. Uno equality. Right. All right. Let's see. 331. I think we've had this one before. The worst is when a guy texts me daily how much he wants to see me, and he never asks me out for a date.
I mean, you could ask him out. You could be like, so when are we meeting up? I don't like these one-sided.
Yeah.
Like, he just keeps texting me, and I'm just like, yeah, I want to see you too. And then he's like, I want to see you. And then I'm like, I want to see, you know, well, you can break the,
right?
cycle.
Right.
We all have the power. Stand up.
Let's meet.
Yeah. Hey, when are you free?
Right.
All right. That's my take.
Share
on
a
it.
Calendar.
Right? Yeah. Share a Google calendar. Share a Yahoo calendar. Share an iCal.
There's all sorts of calendars. 630, the worst are people who take cell phone calls in the bathroom. public bathrooms.
I actually saw a sign today in an office bathroom with a picture of one of those little office people on a toilet holding a phone and then an X through it.
What?
Yeah. So apparently it's a big enough issue that in some corporate restrooms it's being addressed, because
Some
people in HR had to make a graphic because people are being a little bold with where they take their calls these days. We're so connected.
Jeannie, can I, last thing I need you, I know you got Photoshop on your computer. Can you make a graphic? Wow. 815, very specific here. Not rinsing, the worst is not rinsing the soap out of the swimsuit before getting in a hot tub.
Why is there soap in your swimsuit?
Huh.
You serial killer.
There must be something about that. Like, I would assume that the, like, maybe that hurts.
Well, I think that technically before you go into a pool or a hot tub, you are supposed to take a shower. But I've never gone as far as to soap.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you do rinse so that everybody around you doesn't think that you're, you know, breaking the rule. But I never go full
but
soap.
But I feel like this is one of those, and I don't want to get crass on it, but I feel like it's one of those, they're snickering going, because it hurts, you know, soap in your private parts. Like, I feel like I don't understand what the issue is there. You know what I mean? Like, they're not saying it, but they are saying, I don't know. You know what I mean?
I saw the problem.
Who would care if you had soap not rinsed out? Is it uncomfortable?
Yeah. Huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Something. So obviously you've got something 815 that we don't know about.
Yeah, there's a mystery there.
There's a mystery there.
Yeah, unravel that one for us.
Right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. All right, we'll take our break here. We will get our lineup for the best worsts, and we will continue with the worst. We got Ricardo's on the line. Also, some more text to get through. So we'll get to him. Mary and Dave in studio. Stay with us.
It's going down.
All right, so download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Dave Metz, and Mary Novohusky in studio. We are playing the worst, 312-981-7200. Coming up here, we've got Ricardo. Ricardo, what's the worst, Ricardo?
Hey, I'm here. How you doing?
Good. How about you?
Oh, not bad at all. Just got off of work. But speaking of the red line, going, you know, towards Evanston. Okay. First of all, yeah, people like remember the lady earlier about the people play the loud music.
Yeah.
Oh God, that's so annoying. How about the gum poppers and the gum chewers? You know.
Yeah.
Gum poppers. Gum
yeah, you
chewers,
don't like the gums.
Man.
Huh?
I hate that. You know, cackety cackety pow.
I like the onomatopoeia this guy has. This is great.
You go to the next train, and then there's another person doing the same thing. Okay, one more. Okay, you know the homeless people be on the trains, you know, like usually during the day. So, okay, I'm going to condense this real quick. You see the same person in the red light, you know, going to where I go, you know, downtown Chicago.
Oh, man. What happened? We lost Ricardo. Darn it.
He was
about to get there. I think it, because the summary was that I forgot what it was, but it was listed on there. Ah, bummer. Okay.
I feel like you just kind of voted for Jasmine, though.
Yeah, exactly. Like
part of it was just supporting someone else's.
Something about
someone else's calling. So I'll
815 hilariously. 815. There's people that are laughing at me saying, "No, it makes a ton of bubbles, like soap bubbles in the hot tub."
Oh.
And now they're laughing at me for thinking it was something dirty. But you can see where I was going. It says, and 815 says, the worst is listening to Justin talk about soap and private parts when I'm sure the person meant bubbles in the hot tub from the soap, LOL. Yeah, that's true. I didn't know. Never had that happen.
I've never even heard of that.
Yeah, but yeah. I don't mind a couple extra bubbles in the hot tub. It's already bubbling.
Yeah, right?
It's a little more bubbly.
All right, here we go. the worst is when your ball cap flies off in the wind and you run after it like a coyote and you almost nail it with your shoe only to have another gust of wind swoop in at the last moment like the Roadrunner and lift the hat right away from your foot.
Very visual.
I've actually lost a hat right over here on this bridge. Like
in
when I first
Michigan Avenue? Yeah.
Yeah. Flew right off my head right over the side of the bridge.
Oh, bummer.
But it was one of those like hipster, like, what do they call those? Like a fedora? And it was kind of a good thing that I lost.
Yeah, it was meant to go.
Yeah. It was its time.
The universe was telling you something, huh? Yeah. All right. The worst is just baking a perfect batch of cookies, then realizing I messed up on baking powder and baking soda and didn't tell anyone until they bit into them. The look on their faces were priceless. I guess you mix up those two things. That's
yeah,
going to make it gross.
Probably tastes bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to cook. So
yeah. All right, I don't know what this is. The worst is my wife and I were riding the bus one weekend downtown, and a couple of Japanese tourists were using some translation app on the phone to eavesdrop on what we were saying.
What?
They had their phones pointed our way and were laughing at us. Okay.
Well, I like that. I feel like I'm going to do that next time I go to a foreign country now. Be the obnoxious American tourist, like, huh, what did you say? And just lean my phone in directly into their faces.
Right.
You like that?
Could you say that a little clearer, please?
Oh, you called me a fat American? Very clever.
All right, we'll roll quick through here. 646, the worst is when you walk out of a room and then forget what you were going for. Silver lining, walk right back in and you'll probably remember. They have something to do with crossing the door threshold.
Again, dementia is the worst.
Yeah, right. 630, the worst, getting up at 6, showering, dressing for work, realizing it's Saturday.
Oh, classic.
Mm. Yeah. The worst, caulking.
Yeah.
Agree.
Caulking.
I'm into that one, man. That's the worst.
Now, I like Rory. He's got a lot of character.
630 says the worst is when your phone dies right when you're trying to text. The worst. And it says WOR.
I think we just say when your phone dies in any moment where you need it. We have a couple of those. Yeah.
We got to do something about these phones.
Yeah, we got to fix these phones.
214 says my ex-boyfriend and his buddies who used to try and one-up each other by burping the alphabet in Pig Latin or Spanish.
I'm glad that's your ex. So, yeah.
How do you burp? You can't do Pig Latin for letters. That doesn't make any. What are you saying? AA? I'm sorry, I call BS on this. I think you made
eBay,
this up.
Yeah.
You got an axe to grind with your ex. Don't bring that trash to the WGN, all right?
I had one more in here that I wanted to get to before we wrapped up here, because it was from Jerry and his wife, and it was about a bird, and I had it, and I lost it.
Oh, man, I love Jerry
and his
wife.
The worst, but I admit, also the best, when a mother bird builds a nest on your balcony and has eggs, you don't own your balcony anymore since the mom flies away and squawks the whole time when you're out there. No peace at all. But when you get a chance to peep into the nest and see the baby birds, it just warms your heart, smiles and grins all around.
Oh, that's so sweet.
That is the sweetest worst of all time.
That is the sweetest worst of all
time. Because I agree, Jerry and wife, I will take the other side that's got to be super obnoxious and annoying, especially in the morning when if it's close to where you're sleeping. You'd be like, oh, I'm glad for nature, but knock it off.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have like a kind enough heart to just let that happen.
Yeah.
Right.
I think I'd be like, oh my gosh, the nest, it fell.
Whoops.
All right, that's going to do it. 312-981-7200. All right, so we've got Dave Metz and Mary Novohovsky in studio. Dave's podcast is Palm Pilots, which is about pornography. Mary, she does a show coming up called Ladylike, which will be at Cafe Mustache on July 17th.
Yep.
You both do the podcast together, Impress Me With Music, which is on iTunes. The first one came out today.
The first one came out today. Hopefully it's up. If not, just look it up tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, it's iTunes, right?
iTunes. It's around there. We're pretty pumped about it.
Somebody took a break. Someone had to eat a hoagie. It's your time to press publish on this thing, and they're like, we'll get it tomorrow.
Yeah.
All right, so we got some prizes to give away tonight. Here we go. Here's what we got. 2 adult and 2 child general admissions to Sycamore Speedway this 27 race season. Visit SycamoreSpeedway.com. We got one of those. Also, Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at LouMalnati's.com.
Delicious.
All right. So we're going to be giving away... You know what? I'm going to give 2 of the Sycamore Speedways away and 2 of the pizzas, okay? So we want 4 today. Ooh, was everybody excited? All right, so here we go. So for the Sycamore Speedway, we are going to give to 506. The worst is when married couples or couples dress up in matching outfits or wear complimentary T-shirts. Yeah, that's the worst.
That's
right?
The worst.
Yeah.
That's pretty bad.
Agreed.
That's bad. That's just bad in general.
I'm going to do it, but
no,
it's bad.
You won't do it. Yeah, right. Okay. 773, you're going to get the Sycamore Speedway tonight. The worst is when you order a plain cheeseburger from McDonald's and you drive away only to discover at home that they gave you 2 pieces of bread and cheese.
Cheeseburger Jones, man. Enjoy that.
And you got a pro tip from Dave. Just go in and say that a manager told you that you had a wrong order yesterday and you'd probably get some free food.
And his name was probably Mike.
And it was probably Mike. All right, for the pizzas tonight, here we go. You know what? We're going to do this because we feel for Bonnie. We're going to give Bonnie one of the pizzas because she had told a story about how her dog had vomited all over the bad landscaping in front of the building. It just took a long time to get there.
A long time, but she
and 2 different mediums.
She pushed through.
She pushed through to not only tell 3/4 of the story on the phone, but she turned around and gave the punchline on the text. So that's a lot of effort tonight, Bonnie, and we appreciate it. So you're going to get a pizza. And first place tonight, who's also going to get a pizza for, I would think, one of the most, I would think, universal worst, and one that is going to be in the Hall of Fames, is people who use their iPhone. Don't use the earbuds on the train and use the speakerphone to play music on the train. Jasmine, who calls in a lot to the station, nailed it. The idea that that is the worst, the people that don't use headphones to listen to music when they're on the train. Ridiculous.
I like him, but...
Yay, Jasmine.
Jasmine wins, but you like it, but I just...
It's the sound of the city, you know? You should enjoy it. Drink it in.
All right. Well, it was a good to worst. Dave, Mary, thanks so much for playing.
Thanks for having us.
All right, that's going to do it tonight here for The Download. Tomorrow night, Michael Darling's going to join us. He's the chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art. We'll talk about the new Murakami exhibit, The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg. Which, if you want to be any sort of celebrity, that's where you take your selfie. That's where. I mean, if you're looking at anyone, they're like, oh, they're in front of it. There's a picture of Chance. Then the U2 was in town.
Right.
That's the new hot selfie. If you're looking to be like the celebrities.
Patty
Vasquez,
off the beaten path selfie. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. How are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you too. I'm good.
It was fun to march with you at Pride Parade.
Wasn't
that
amazing? Yeah. The best weather for Pride.
I know, right? It really was.
It was gorgeous, and that band that we had was wonderful. Yeah, it was a
great, great, great day. All right, so what do you got tonight?
We have John Tatey of the AV Club and host of the AV Club with John Tatey on Fusion Television. We have Representative Robert Martwick to talk about the House of Representatives' new budget that they're presenting today. They presented, and what happens next? And we also have Craig Bolano, who is going to give us an overview on the Bitcoin. I don't know. Do you understand Bitcoins at all?
I don't know if I do. I've never used it, but I guess I understand the structure of it.
I don't.
But it's one of those things that if you're going to start a currency and it's not fully... if you don't not everybody uses it, it's really difficult to use it.
Exactly.
That's the problem, right?
Well, and I loved the conversation that you had about the banking and local banking and that relationship.
Yeah, right.
Because it was wonderful because I used to work in the lobby of, I won't say which bank, but they were trying to convince customers to add their photo to the front of their credit cards. And it was impossible to convince people. My job was to take their photographs. And people just hated having me stop them and talk to them. But what was fascinating was how many people hated using the ATM machines. I have always wanted to have I'm one of those people it's my money. I want to hand it off to somebody.
Right.
I want to have a conversation with somebody. But that was a great conversation.
Yeah, I don't think that my dad has ever used an ATM. It's just not his thing. Yeah.
No, I don't think my mom has either. Yeah. I haven't used one in years.
They have cash all the time.
I don't.
I'll be like, Dad, I got a card. It's like, no, I got cash. I'm like, where do you get that cash if you're not? I guess you just go to the bank once a month. You're like, I got it. All right.
Yeah. My dad, too. He always had cash, too.
Yeah, it's strange. I guess it's a generational.
All right.
Have a great show.